Good Wednesday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad that you've joined us today. We have a fantastic program for you. Katie Pavich of Town Hall join us on the program in just a little bit. Talking about the primary results in New Hampshire last night. Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, both winning big. We'll also talk about Hillary Clinton talking about the immunity for the gun industry. She's not being honest about the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which is not surprising. Also, not surprising to me anyway, the fact that Hillary Clinton's big push, at least in New Hampshire anyway, to try to be the gun control candidate, to try to use that as a wedge issue between her and Bernie Sanders, failed miserably in New Hampshire. Didn't do anything to get her within even single digits of Bernie Sanders last night. Hillary, of course, has said that she's going to make gun control a centerpiece of her campaign. And Iowa didn't seem to do much. And New Hampshire hasn't done anything. But I'm sure she's going to keep trying. We'll also talk from the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Mr. Brian Pigman Quokka is going to join us later on in the hour. Next hour, Tom Scott of FN America on the new military collector series that FN's coming out with. We'll also be heading up there, I believe, in hour three as well. Maybe a piece that I was able to do earlier today. Coming up next hour as well, Kelsey Harkness from the Daily Signal with the latest on Operation Choke Point, the federal program that was targeting industries that apparently DOJ found unacceptable. Payday lenders, pawn shops, anything in the firearms industry. There are and there have been attempts in Congress to try to end Operation Choke Point. We'll get the latest with Kelsey Harkness from the Daily Signal. Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report, join us in Hour 3, talking more about the New Hampshire primary. His latest piece, The Beginning of the End of Hillary, ? Maybe. We'll see. We'll see what happens in South Carolina. Really, we'll see what happens, I think, 1st of March, when you have the SEC primary, more than a dozen states heading to the polls. But, yeah, there is much consternation in Camp Clinton today. Heather Marchese, 1 million moms against gun control, much jubilation in the mountains and the hollers of West Virginia as permitless carry passing out of the West Virginia House, heading over to the Senate side, did pass with a veto-proof majority. Governor Earl Ray Tomlin there in West Virginia has already stated that he would veto this bill, as he did last year. In the last legislative session, they had that veto-proof majority. They just didn't have the time because Earl Ray Tomlin vetoed the bill after the session had ended. So this year, the legislature is going back. They're redoing the bill. They're going to try to get it to the governor's desk early enough that that won't be a factor. And step one of that process has concluded with the permitless carry bill now heading over to the state Senate side. In New Hampshire last night, one of the first questions that I had, and we've talked about this with Selena Zito and others, what was the turnout in New Hampshire? Record high turnout, according to the Secretary of State Bill Gardner, predicting a record 550,000 ballots representing 62% of the Granite State's registered voters. The previous record set in 2008 with 530,000 voters. So record turnout. And once again, just like we saw in Iowa, there were more Republicans voting than Democrats, at least according to the New York Post. They say the projected split, 282,000 GOP ballots, 268,000 Democratic voters in the battleground state of New Hampshire. So you want to look at turnout, and you want to look at where that how the numbers come down, in part to gauge voter enthusiasm and voter intensity, which will matter in the general elections. Right now, you know, Michael Bloomberg says he is weighing a presidential run, says he's monitoring these races and he says he'll decide what he's going to do by early March. March the 2nd is the primary date, or March the 1st is the primary date in the state of Texas, and the filing for independent candidates begins on March the 2nd. So that's why you're looking at early March. Strategically, Bloomberg would have a better idea of the map for the rest of the primaries. But one of the big considerations, well, in fact, one of the arguments that we see in favor of a Mike Bloomberg candidacy, and we're going to get to some of the latest pieces on this, is that there is this huge number of Americans, independent voters, unaffiliated voters, who are dissatisfied with the status quo and who will not vote for either the Republican candidate or the Democratic candidate, leaving the door wide open for a presidential run by Michael Bloomberg. But so far, what we've seen in Iowa, record turnout for the caucuses, record turnout in New Hampshire for the first primary. And I imagine there are a lot of unaffiliated voters, independent voters, who were voting in New Hampshire, at least in the open primary there. It does not suggest that you have you might have a dissatisfied electorate. The primary results to date and the caucus results in Iowa to date would indicate that. But it doesn't mean that these voters are so disaffected and displeased with the status quo in Washington, D.C., that they are staying home right now. It looks like there is enthusiasm among the electorate to get out there and vote. Looks like there's a little bit more enthusiasm on the Republican side right now in terms of the raw numbers of votes. Again, we'll see how that plays out over the primary season. But it seems to me that if there were a moment right now where America was calling for somebody else to get into the race, that we were so displeased with the choices before us, we'd be talking about record low turnout in the primaries, not record high turnout. Not that that necessarily matters, again, to candidate Bloomberg. And it certainly doesn't matter, I think, to those who would benefit by a Bloomberg candidacy. Douglas Schoen, you know, he was recently in the Wall Street Journal laying out the case for a Bloomberg presidency. He's got a piece at Fox News today. Interestingly enough, the Wall Street Journal, when Doug Schoen had this piece laying out the case for a Bloomberg candidacy, the Wall Street Journal at least said he's been a longtime advisor to Bloomberg. He's Bloomberg's pollster. No such disclaimer at Fox News. They say he served as a pollster for President Bill Clinton. Okay. Also serving as a pollster for the guy who may be jumping into the race. Anyway, his piece at Fox News, Trump and Sanders win. We are witnessing a full-scale revolt, America. So the guy who would like to get a fat contract from Michael Bloomberg to do polling throughout the election cycle says we are in full revolt. The political outsiders have taken control of this election. Hint, hint, boss, fat check. He says, to my mind, Tuesday night's results show that there are finally politicians who understand how marginalized, disenfranchised, and betrayed a majority of Americans feel. He says it's both Republicans and Democrats, including the 42% of Americans who now identify as independents because they think the two parties don't represent their values and politicians. He says, we are seeing a full-scale rejection of the political establishment. He says it's a threat we didn't take serious enough over the past few years, as evidenced by the fact that most rejected Trump as a clown and a joke. Yeah, kind of like the guy who, you know, you might be getting a fat contract for if you decide to run for president. 46% of GOP voters say they feel betrayed by Republican politicians. Trump, he says, won 32% of that vote. He says, we did the same thing to Bernie Sanders, who began this race upwards of 50 points behind Hillary Clinton. We said a socialist could never win. And he may not be able to win a national election, but we are seeing an electorate so starved for an honest and trustworthy politician that they will make allowances for ideologies that they may not have considered before. Which is interesting. I will say this is honestly interesting that Douglas Schoen brings this up because a recent poll on candidate Bloomberg found that his negatives, his highest negatives were the fact that he was considered to be dishonest and untrustworthy. And here's Douglas Schoen saying, hey, listen, you know, people will vote for Sanders even if they aren't a socialist because they well, at least he's saying what he believes. Schoen says, Sanders is just Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump is just Donald Trump. Is Michael Bloomberg just Michael Bloomberg? Is he just Michael Bloomberg? Or is he every town for gun safety? Is he Moms Demand Action? Is he Mayors Against Illegal Guns? Is he, I couldn't tell you the name of the soda tax groups and stuff. It seems to me like Michael Bloomberg is not just Michael Bloomberg. That Michael Bloomberg is Bloomberg News. Michael Bloomberg is Bloomberg View, which was the editorial site that Bloomberg put together a couple of years ago to reflect his opinion on issues. But you know, again, for a guy who spent how many tens of millions of dollars on anti-gun laws and trying to elect anti-gun politicians, how many times does Bloomberg actually appear in the ad making his case as opposed to celebrities or, you know, other proxies? Is Michael Bloomberg Michael Bloomberg? Or is Michael Bloomberg a bunch of other people saying what Michael Bloomberg wants them to say? Douglas Schoen says that we are living in a time when trust in American institutions have collapsed. He says a recent Pew survey shows that less than 20% of Americans trust the government always or most of the time, and a CNN poll showed that 60% think the American dream is unachievable today. Against this backdrop, he says, it's no surprise that America is in revolt. Honesty and trustworthiness matters more than whether a candidate has experience or can win in November, according to voters, and the establishment isn't delivering anything resembling what the American populace desires in their political leaders. He said, I see a clearer path to nomination for Trump than for Sanders, but there is no doubt that Americans have spoken and they are done with business as usual. Again, kind of hinting that, you know, in a crazy election year, anything can happen. Boss, cut that contract. Let me start doing polling for you all around the country. Over at Politico, Jack Schaefer has a column on why the media would love to see Michael Bloomberg run. Now, this is important, too. The American people appear not to have gotten the message and the hints and the telegraphing that, you know, we're supposed to now start calling for Michael Bloomberg to get into the race. You haven't seen that, have you? You haven't seen any spontaneous demonstrations outside of his mansion in Bermuda or New York City or Colorado or wherever else he owns property saying, Michael, get into the race. You haven't seen that. What you have seen are, again, a lot of columns like the one that I just mentioned by Douglas Schoen, a lot of columns by, like this one by Jack Schaefer, who says that his not-quite announcement has reporters salivating. He says, by giving the campaign a third dimension, making the race more like the caroming and crashing of three billiard balls in a two-person horse race, Bloomberg's independent run will trash enough of 2016's coverage to force reporters to start over. Trump's billions must now be compared to Bloomberg's more ample billions. Bloomberg's centrism will encroach on the centristic thinking of Jeb Bush and John Kasich. Centrism? Really? That's fascinating. His social liberalism will displace much of what Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have brought to the political market. His common sense approach to issues will puncture a bit of the Tory fervor of Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. Yeah. Cable news and Sunday morning shows will punch and gouge each other to give him a platform. I don't doubt that would be the case. Although, again, keep in mind, he already has Bloomberg News. So he has his platform. Schaefer says there's a vast buffet of Bloomberg stories there for the grabbing, should Bloomberg announce. Stories about his money, his New York City mayoralty, his high-voltage wonkery, his money, his wacky centrism, his media empire, his personal relationships, his money, his crusades against soda, guns, and trans fat, and, of course, his money. The New York Press Corps, Schaefer says, already the beneficiary of a Trump candidacy that has permitted them to recycle decades of celebrity real estate reporting into their Trump campaign coverage will win similar residuals when, Schaefer says, Bloomberg announces. He says the beauty of the Bloomberg candidacy from a reporter's point of view is the breadth and heft of the paper trail that flows regally behind him. No reporter assigned to the Bloomberg for President beat need ever go hungry. There are 12 years of Mayor Mike's technocratic administration. Technocratic. Yeah, not... Okay. To cogitate over. There are a couple of decades of his building out of Bloomberg LP from which journalists can draw to illuminate his thinking and business acumen. And let's not forget the thousands of editorials published by his Bloomberg View since 2011 on everything from trade to illicit drugs to abortion to the Middle East and beyond, which carry the germ, if not the stalk and leaf, of his views on issues. The words, Schaefer says, and the editorials might not be his, but the sentiments nearly always are. He loves wrestling with reporters, Schaefer says, once telling New York City reporters he would cancel future news conferences if they kept asking questions he didn't want to answer. Well, that doesn't really sound like he enjoys wrestling with reporters. That sounds like he enjoys bossing them around. If you enjoy wrestling with reporters, as Jack Schaefer says, you enjoy that give and take. You enjoy that back and forth, right? The repartee. If you don't love wrestling with reporters, that's when you tell them, I will cancel future news conferences if you keep asking me these types of questions. Oh, goodness. Schaefer says the Bloomberg candidacy will also enrich journalism by waving the policy fluorescer over issues that have gone underexamined this season. Such as, he doesn't actually say. He says that Bloomberg, who started a company based on the theory that not enough actionable numbers were in the hands of decision makers, has already stated he feels that way about the current campaign debate. But Schaefer doesn't actually say what issues those would be. Like what? Trans fat ban? Anti-gun legislation? Soda bans? Obesity? Too much salt in our food? iPod too loud? Maybe he and Bernie can get together on the deodorant problem facing America, where we apparently have too many companies making too many different kinds of deodorant. What issues exactly will be fluoresced that aren't currently being fluoresced if a Bloomberg were to get in? Schaefer says, I won't bet against him entering the race, and I won't bet against him winning. He says a Bloomberg candidacy would redefine the range and tone of the political argument, changing the story, and thereby giving reporters a chance to renew themselves. If you need Michael Bloomberg to get into the presidential race in order to renew yourself as a journalist, maybe it's just time to not be a journalist. Maybe it's time to go do something else. Because it seems to me that right now, even before Michael Bloomberg were to get into the race, if in fact he does get into the race as an independent, right now, this is an election in which we have serious issues. We have serious issues regarding our individual liberty, our individual freedom. You have two, it seems, almost binary competing points of view on the role that the government should play in our life, both our personal life, the economic life of the country. Seems to me like there's already a lot of work that journalists could be doing covering this election without getting silly or stupid or facile. And it seems to me that the addition of one more candidate isn't going to be the reason that will turn things around for journalism. Journalists don't need another candidate to get in the race. They need to realize and start to report on the truly important issues, instead of treating this like it's political theater, which for them it is. For them, this is political theater. Which is why Schaefer's whole column here is on why journalists would love to see a Michael Bloomberg get into the race. Pass the popcorn. That would be so much more exciting. Not a peep, not a word from Schaefer. Again, on the reality across this country, where despite the op-eds in the Wall Street Journal and the opinion pieces at Politico and the floating out there of the idea, even the interview in the Financial Times that Bloomberg gave where he himself said, yes, I'm thinking about it. Out in the real world, America hasn't really responded. But inside the Beltway, in Midtown Manhattan, those self-professed thought leaders, oh, they're salivating over the idea of a Bloomberg candidacy. For all the wrong reasons. All right, we got to take a time out. When we come back, Katie Pavlich joins us from Town Hall. We'll talk about the primary results in New Hampshire. We'll talk about Hillary Clinton, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. So stick around. Later on in the hour, we'll head back to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the Great American Outdoor Show as well. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this.
Speaking with Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums, the National Firearms Museum, what's it all about?
Well, you know, we got three museums now. We used to be the museum. Now we're three museums. And this is the home museum, the NRA National Firearms Museum. This is our 80th year of existence. And we are here at the NRA headquarters building. We've got about 3,000 firearms on display. And we have a number of spectacular new exhibits that have just popped up this past year. Usually it's exciting to get maybe one exhibit every other year. But this year we've got a great steampunks guns exhibit that shows fanciful guns that are artists' creations from steampunk fantasy. And then we compare those to actual guns from the Victorian era that kind of have the same sensibility about them and see if you can tell what's real and what's fake. We've also put in exhibits on America's pistol. And I'm very excited about this one. We have been able to reunite for the first time in a century the two actual pistols that did the head-to-head shootout in 1911 for the U.S. Army to pick their issue sidearm, the Savage Model 1911 45 ACP and the Colt Model 1911, both in 45 ACP, and of course the Colt won that head-to-head challenge. But these were the actual guns that were used in those trials, along with a number of other guns that were experimental models leading up to that.
Right, before we run out of time, how do folks get more information about the NRA National Firearms Museum?
Well, they can come visit us at the NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. If they can't get by, they can come visit us on the website nramuseums.com.
All right, Jim Sapega, director of the NRA Museums. That's the NRA National Firearms Museum here in Fairfax. Thank you for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, John.
Speaking with Shade McMillan with H&M Black Nitride, welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is H&M Black Nitride? What's it all about?
We are, as opposed to all the different finishes that are out here in coatings, we are a heat treat business. And we service all the major OEMs and single gun customers at the SHOT Show.
How does it work?
It basically is a heat treat process that turns the parts black, adds corrosion protection, and it's a very slick and hard surface.
So it's I imagine that something, besides having a look to it, it's also great protective.
Yes. Very hard, very durable. The corrosion is extremely, there's nothing that can beat it.
Nothing basically. That can beat it. And you guys are working with a lot of guys who would probably can attest to that. You got Bruce Pyatt, Tony Holmes, Doug Koenig, all signed on as sponsors.
Yes.
So why are they using it? Tell me why a shooter would want to use this.
When you have your gun and you're all on the range and in the elements and you're competing, then you can't always take care of your weapon. It's a tool. Okay? It's not all meant to be pretty. What we do is provide that corrosion protection, that wear protection, that makes sure that they feel confident that their gear is always going to work.
It's H&M Black Nitride. I imagine, Shay, this has got, like, implications not only with shooting, with the military, with
yes.
law enforcement.
Yeah,
I mean,
we do a lot of aerospace work, locomotive. We have stuff in outer space for NASA we do.
Wow, that's cool. And you guys are also working over with your shooters here, but also with NRA over at Bianchi Cup as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, Bianchi Cup. My brother and I have been competing out there for 3 years. This will be our fourth year.
Cool.
We were the barbecue sponsor last year for the Yankee Cup. And it's a great competition, very family-like, and we're a family-owned business, so we like that.
Awesome. How are we getting more information about H&M Black Knight?
www.blacknightride.com.
Shay, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. We're going to go back to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania here in just a little bit to the Great American Outdoor Show, talk with our friend Brian Kwaka, the pig man. But right now I want to welcome to the program from Town Hall our friend Katie Pavlich. Katie, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Cam?
I'm good. All right. You sound chipper and bright, so you must have it wasn't really a too late a night with the New Hampshire primary results, was it?
Night, but we're used to that around here. You know, well, being in politics, there's no sleep for us, so sleep is one of those extra things you get once in a while.
Yeah.
I guess that's how it is when you have children too, so
at least for the first couple of years, until they settle down. The top line results were known pretty early on. Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, the victors. There was, a clear race, not really for second place. John Kasich on the Republican side coming in second pretty handily, but a real race for number three on the Republican side. And the biggest question of the night, you know, going in for Hillary Clinton was, we had seen some polls suggesting that maybe she was closing the gap on Bernie Sanders. Would she be able to finish in the running? And, Katie, the answer was a resounding no.
Hillary Clinton got completely clobbered last night. I mean, not even a close competition. She lost to Bernie Sanders by a significant portion. He won 60.4% of the vote, and she won 38% of the vote. And by the way, we have all the election results up at townhall.com if you're interested in seeing all the details. But she lost every single demographic outside of senior citizens in New Hampshire. Keep in mind, she won New Hampshire in 2008 against Barack Obama after she lost to Iowa. She didn't stand a chance in the state. And by the way, it's not because Bernie Sanders is in Vermont right next door. It's because people don't trust her. The exit polling on her was incredible, seeing that, you know, Bernie Sanders won 95% to 3% on who voters determine are more honest and trustworthy. Hillary Clinton completely lost women, especially young women, which is key because, you know, her being the first female president, women are going to vote for her, was, of course, a centerpiece of her campaign. We've heard her repeatedly say she's an outsider because she's a woman. She's not establishment because she's a woman trying to be the first president, female president. That's a big deal. And I think that Madeleine Albright and that other horrible woman, and I can't even remember her name right now because she's so irrelevant, basically shaming young women, saying, you know, that they're really voting for Sanders because they want to chase boys, or that there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women. It really just shows how out of touch Hillary is when it comes to, quote, women's issues and the fact that they care about more than just electing the first female president. Well, so it's really interesting to watch.
And it's not even about electing the first female president for Hillary. It's about electing Hillary for Hillary.
Right.
I mean, and that's the thing, you know.
Right.
And it's so transparent. It's elect me. I would be the first female president. Whereas Bernie Sanders, and I don't agree with Bernie Sanders on pretty much anything that I've seen, but, you know, he's doing a much better job of building a movement, saying, listen, it's not about me, it's about you, right? And if you're trying to appeal to young millennial voters, heck, if you're trying to appeal to voters in this political environment where we distrust Washington, D.C., where we dislike a lot of what we see, a message of send me and make history. No, that's going to be an awful argument to make to an electorate. It's much better to make that argument of, hey, we're going to build something together, and you're going to be a part of this revolutionary change here. I think the test will be whether or not that carries forward. I will say, in rural Virginia, I'm seeing Bernie Sanders signs. I'm also seeing a lot of Republican signs, but I'm not seeing Hillary Clinton bumper stickers and things like that.
Well, that's because Hillary Clinton hasn't been out into the Virginia countryside in a long time, Cam. That's a little too much for her to handle. I don't know if the limos drive out that far. but, yeah, it's true. I mean, Bernie Sanders, you know, we'll see how he does moving forward, just because there's more to presidential elections than just the voters in primaries, unfortunately, there's also this issue of delegates, right? And Hillary Clinton has already locked up almost 400 superdelegates going into South Carolina. And sure, she may, have barely won Iowa, which is questionable still, lost New Hampshire in a landslide, but there is this other piece of the puzzle that we have to keep in mind. But you're absolutely right. And in going into the general, say Hillary does eventually squeak it out against Sanders. All those Sanders voters, do you really think they're going to show up to the polls and vote for Hillary?
Oh,
I don't think they are.
I don't think they are either. In fact,
so they have a turnout problem on their hands.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, in fact, there's a story today, Betsy Woodruff at the Daily Beast, did Bernie just poison Hillary 2016, where she quotes a number of Bernie Sanders supporters saying that they would never under any circumstances vote for Hillary Clinton. But, look, and you talk about a turnout issue. We're already kind of seeing this in both Iowa and New Hampshire. Record high turnout numbers, right? But also more Republicans turning out to vote than Democrats.
Right, exactly. And so, it's good for Republicans going into, the South and seeing how they can work there. It's not good for Hillary or the DNC when it comes to, of course, their plans for Hillary to have been the nominee. It's just interesting to see and watch where this is going. And you're absolutely right about Bernie Sanders talking directly to the people. That's why he's been able to get the millennial vote. As much as I say, they're wrong. I mean, it was capitalism that brought them the iPhone that they're, sending $20 donations to Bernie Sanders on, not socialism, but that's a whole other story. But, it's true. That's why he's appealing to them.
Absolutely. I think in many ways he's catering to them, whereas Hillary wants you to cater to her.
So there's a difference between pandering and catering, by the way.
There is. Oh, they're totally.
Hillary has not figured out yet.
If I just go on Ellen and do the robot, that'll work. And that'll show how hip I am. Anyway, what do you think about the prospects for Bloomberg getting into the race?
Ooh, I actually don't think that this is necessarily something that won't happen, especially considering the likely chances that Hillary Clinton will be indicted. I think that if he wants to get in the race, that's fine. He can split the vote on the left side of the aisle for once. It's usually the vote of the independent is getting split on the right side of the aisle. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, he's dabbled in this multiple times before, but as did Donald Trump before he decided to get in the race, right? We heard for years that Donald Trump was going to run for president and finally doing it. So maybe this will just be the year of the billionaires running against Bernie Sanders. But again, there you are with the billionaire problem, right? I don't think that Michael Bloomberg's going to be able to take Sanders' appeal away, considering the big problem with Hillary is that she has too much money. And people feel like they're getting screwed by people like her.
It seems to me like he would be the replacement candidate for Hillary Clinton supporters. That would
right.
be sort of his natural constituency.
Well, right. And whether that can be successful or not, I
right.
don't know.
Well, if there aren't, one would think if there weren't enough voters to get her nominated in the primary election, that there wouldn't be enough voters to get the proxy candidate elected president and a general. But as you say, it is early, and we will see. But
and on that note, I mean, Bernie Sanders won gun owners last night as well, which is interesting. Not overall, but just
on the progressive Democrat side,
he won that demographic. So I doubt that Bloomberg getting in the race is going to do much, do anything to really get those people, of course.
Absolutely.
Side.
And it's interesting because according to, I forget what story it was, Hillary, like 1 in 4 of her ads in New Hampshire focused on gun control, whereas in Iowa it was like 1 in 17 ads mentioned gun control. So clearly she or her campaign thought that a pro-gun control message would resonate in a state like New Hampshire, where the governor recently vetoed a permitless carry bill that passed out of the legislature. I don't know why she thought it would be a good idea to make this, a gun control stand, but it did not pay any political dividends for her.
Well, I am baffled at this idea that Democrats are openly running on a very anti-gun, even confiscation policy platform. When you look at what happened in 1994 with the historic turnover of the House after the assault weapons bill was signed into law, that was at a time when the NRA didn't necessarily have a very good standing with the American people, and the polling on gun control was opposite than it is now. Today, as you know, there are more people in America who believe that gun rights should be protected, not infringed upon with more gun rights. Mm-hmm. The tables have turned, and yet you still have people like Hillary Clinton openly running on this issue. I just don't understand it. I mean, let's not forget that Rahm Emanuel, when he was still President Obama's chief of staff, he told him not to bring it up as an issue until he was well into his second term as president, because he would lose his second term if he decided to make it a first-term issue. And this is I don't really understand who is saying that this is a good thing to run on. It makes no sense to me.
I think his name rhymes with Schmoomberg.
And I
think he has committed to, you know, funding a lot of anti-gun candidates out there in 2016. And I think that was, you know, the thought process of, we'll tell these candidates, we got the media involved, got the front page of the New York Times saying it's time to ban these guns. Clearly Americans are calling for this, even though clearly Americans were buying more firearms and becoming concealed carry holders. That's what Americans were actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
But within the thought leader class, right, the commentariat, there was an almost universal desire to do something truly big and sweeping on gun control. And so, you know, if that's your world that you live in, then, you think it's the time is ripe. And when you've got a deep-pocketed donor like Bloomberg saying that I'll back you if you back my bills, I think that they thought that that it could work. The question is, do they actually stick with this, or do they prove that that no, actually this was all a political gambit? It really wasn't a principled stand on a anti-gun position. If it looks like it's going to hurt us electorally, we're going to start backing off well before the election.
Well, and then I would say, you know, from political strategy standpoint, from their end, that would probably be wise for them. But then on, you know, our side of it, that doesn't mean that the positions no longer exist.
Exactly.
Right? They've just been honest about it and open with it, which has been detrimental to their political prospects. But that doesn't mean that that's not what they actually mean to do once they get into office or have the opportunity to put Supreme Court justices onto the court. I mean, just because it goes away doesn't mean it actually does, if that makes sense.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, again, it's the mindset, I think, of the political class versus the mindset of the voters. We remember this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the politicians think that, you know, well, once the news cycle goes away, the electorate will forget. No, we might not remember all of the details. You probably won't remember like a vote, what was that vote? 58-42 or was it 55? You know, whatever. But we'll remember the big stuff. We'll remember when a candidate said, yeah, you know what, I'm okay with banning guns. Hey, I think we should limit ammunition. Why do you need more than 2 boxes of ammo at any one time, Katie?
Well, I don't know. Maybe because you go through that in like 15 minutes at the range. But you're right. I mean, I think that a lot of what Hillary Clinton's big problem is that she still thinks being non-transparent will allow her to get away with a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in the age of new media and the internet, that's not the case. And it's more prevalent, or a good example of this now is her refusing to release her Goldman Sachs speeches, right? Her speeches to Wall Street, as if that's something she doesn't have to do in the age of new media. And because she hasn't understood that she's going to be accountable for her own actions, and because she's been around for so long, I think Bernie Sanders understands that. And Hillary Clinton tries to kind of, you know, work her way around the positions that she's held. And I think young people in particular see that and go, no, I saw you on YouTube saying the exact opposite thing. I don't really believe you.
Exactly. Katie, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. It's always a pleasure getting a chance to talk with you, and hopefully we can do this again very soon.
Absolutely. Talk to you.
All right. Katie Pavich from Town Hall joins us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. When we come back, after a quick timeout, we'll head to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to the Great American Outdoor Show. Our friend the Pigman, Brian Kwaka on Sportsman Channel, going to be with us, so stick around. We'll be right back with more Cam and Company right after this.
I'm speaking with Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. Kellyanne, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell folks, what is Armed and Feminine? What do you do and why?
Armed and Feminine is my business that I created to teach firearms training for women only. When I got into shooting several years ago, there was no one I could find that was female, and it was a little difficult because men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
No.
So I went to an NRA training through the Well-Armed Woman and became an instructor, and I came back and started this, and it took off like wildfire. People came from all over the tri-state area. I'm in Pennsylvania, and they loved the idea of women teaching women. You know, we have to know, how does this work? What is it called? What does it do? We have to feel things, touch things, and that's what the entire classes are based around, is women teaching women, because we're different. We have smaller hands. We're not as strong. We're curvier in different ways, totally different on how you have to learn how to shoot.
Right, and especially with certain firearms, the fit, whether it's revolver, semi-automatic, if you're handgun, it's a different fit for a woman's hands versus a man's.
Absolutely, and that's actually one of the draws about my class, is that when someone comes, all they have to do is bring a lunch. I bring everything, eyes, ears, materials, and an array of firearms, and so do my other instructors. So they have an opportunity to pick and choose from all different firearms to see what fits for them, and everything is different. And it's funny, I have a video out that akins the firearm to buying your bra, if we can go there on this segment.
Of course, we always go there here.
But, and I say that nobody can buy your firearm but you. You know, when someone said, oh, my husband bought this for me, and I just want to roll my eyes and go, really?
Honey, I got you a 44 Magnum. It's called the Dirty Harry Special. Enjoy.
Exactly. And they're never going to want to shoot again. Like, guys are like, honey, try this big, big firearm. So we start with 22s till we get all the fundamentals down pat, and then we move up to 380s and 9s until they figure out what it is that they like. But I tell them, you know, it's just like your bra. It's got to be comfortable. It's got to fit right. You got to be able to wear it every day, and it's got to be able to do its job. So only you can do that.
Perfect. Speaking with Kellyanne Pidgeon with Armed and Feminine. So, Kellyanne, you say you're from PA. What part of the state?
I live near Pittsburgh.
Okay. I'm a PA guy myself, and in Virginia now, but it's always good to have a fellow Pennsylvanian here.
I find them everywhere. Actually, I found a man right who lives not by me from
That's here. Awesome. So why was it important that you do? You talked about you didn't find it, but you went way beyond. I can't find a woman to instruct me. You started this whole thing, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of drive.
It does.
What drove you to do this?
I know how much I enjoyed it and what learning this trade did for me in terms of confidence, et cetera. I'm all about mentoring women. I won the Athena Award locally for mentoring women and trying to help move them. And in the classes, I found women who were housekeepers, from housekeepers to attorneys and everybody in between. And what I saw is that women who may be fearful in one way or another, once you teach them how to safely handle a firearm, their confidence just goes through the roof. And if they're having a bad day or they feel like their back's up against the wall for something, they just have to remember, hey, I know how to shoot a gun, and I can do that pretty well. I can do anything. And so, you know, I just enjoy helping people. My real job is in human services, and folks look to me for leadership sort of all the time. And so it was just sort of another calling that I had, and I found it to be a passion. And I thought, if I'd only started this 10 years earlier, this would have been awesome. So I enjoy it. I enjoy every minute of it.
How can folks get more information about Armed and Feminine?
Actually, they can visit my website. It's armedandfeminine.com, and all the tabs are there, from frequently asked questions, class descriptions. All my classes are pretty much sold out for the next season. It's crazy. My entire 2016 season sold out in 5 days. 5 days. I had to add more slots to that during the week to try to just meet the demand.
Okay. So before we run out of time here,
sure.
What's your message to women who are watching us going, should I try that? What do you tell them?
Don't be afraid. You can conquer your fears. It's worth it. And we need to move from being the protected to becoming the protector. And women will save the Second Amendment.
Wow. That's awesome.
Well, they will.
That's awesome.
Give me 30 more seconds. Because women who are the matriarchs of their family, whatever they like, believe in, and support, so will their children. And so women are on the move, and we're moving this, and we're going to be a big part of saving the Second Amendment.
Kellyanne, thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
John, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Now, I will be heading back up to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I'm going to leave Friday night. I'll be up there Saturday, Sunday. So if you're going to go to the Great American Outdoor Show, on the final weekend in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex. Come by, say hi. But I am very pleased to head back up to Harrisburg, virtually anyway, and to talk with our friend, the pig man himself, Brian Quokka. How you doing, brother?
Hey, man. What are you doing? Why are you trying to give me a remote feed? How come you ain't here?
You know, just some technical issues, but I'll be back later on in the week.
Yeah, okay, Cam. Technical. That's what I'm having is a technical issue that you're not here.
Well, I am sorry, but at least we did get a chance to catch up a little bit yesterday in person.
Yeah, we did. How you been doing, man?
Yeah. I'm good, man. I've been doing really well. How about you?
You know, living the dream, buddy. One-eyed, crippled, still sexy. Everything dies, you know, the same old.
You got to have a good crowd there at the Sportsman booth yesterday for your signing?
Man, yesterday seemed, it was a smaller crowd as far as a turnout at the show, but the booth was packed. Today seems super packed as the show goes, but the turnout at the booth wasn't all that great. I don't know what's going on. I think maybe because you ain't here.
I'm sure that's it. Well, listen, you know, it is a fantastic show there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It's a great opportunity for folks to get a chance to meet people like yourself and other Sportsman Channel stars, you know, and get a chance really just to spend some time with them. I mean, you're absolutely... I got to say this, you know, you are a personality, man. But when you get a chance to talk with viewers and fans of the show, you are so gracious. You spend as much time as these folks want, and I know that it drives your manager Justin crazy because you always got somewhere else that you need to be. But you always take the time to talk with the folks who want to take time to talk with you,
dude. I did a seminar yesterday in there, and it's talking about the wreck and how I overcame that. And, I tell you, it was, kind of crazy because I got a little teared up and I don't know why. But I tell you, I built my career on telling people the truth. And, if it wasn't for these fans that turn out to see us, I wouldn't exist. So the least I could do is spend a little bit of time with the people that watch me, that hit us on Facebook, and, watch the greatest, network in the world, Sportsman Channel. How many places can you watch a pig get his face blowed off? Is that wonderful, Cam, or is that just me thinking that?
That's America, buddy, right there. And so tell me, what are we watching now on your adventures here on Sportsman Channel? I just went to your website. I see that there's a T-shirt I've got to get here, the Pork You T-shirt. I'll be making that purchase during the next commercial break.
Cam. I think we have an overage of them in extra small, so I'm going to send you one. What do you think, buddy?
You want
sleeveless wife beater, or what do you want?
We'll get the, if you got any tank tops, I'll take those. You might need a medium instead of the extra small, but.
Yeah, copy.
Yeah.
Remember to mention to all the fans and out there, Cam, is what I do every year when I see you. I give you a pair of boots.
Yes, sir, you do. Huh? Yes, sir. 10 Hall boots.
So you've been lying to me for years saying you're going to go pig hunting with me. Are you ever going to go, or is it just a fictitious trip?
I will go.
You sure?
Yes. Can we go? We can go year-round in Texas, right?
Yep.
Okay. All right, then,
yes. Ready. You got an open invitation.
All right. Well, we'll talk. We'll figure out when it would be advantageous, when you're going to be around, and I will get down there because I would love to go hunting with you.
No, dude, I would really like to get you out there. I finished my seminar today by saying that we have to have Second Amendment protection, and if everybody in the building's not a member of the NRA, get out of my seminar. Get to stepping, because we got to have you, man. NRA is very, very important to what we do and our lifestyle, and I love to see all these little bitty kids that's turned out for this show. It's it warms my heart, dude, especially the little girls. I like to squeeze on them. And I actually took a picture with the 5-month-old baby.
Did you really?
Handed her over. I almost took off running out of the building.
I cannot believe that a parent trusted you with their precious little baby like that. But you took good care of him.
Yeah, I was a little shocked too, Cam. I was.
You know, it is cool. I mean, as you say, it's a very family friendly show there in Harrisburg, and you know there are a lot of families who are walking around. The aisles are nice and wide. There's strollers going through. And that is the next generation. And it does seem like we've got, you know, more Americans who are who are interested in hunting, even if they, you know, live in a big city, they're not afraid now to break out of their comfort zone and to try to find those opportunities to go hunting. I feel pretty good about the future of hunting in this country, don't you?
I do, too. You watch this this new presidential crap going on and all the debates and the lies, and, you know, I won't single anybody out in particular, in Democrats, but they're going to ruin us, man. And people don't understand how great what we do is. You know why? Because they've never went and done it. Don't judge me on Facebook until you know exactly what I'm doing. Go try it. And then if you don't like it, then voice your opinion. If not, shut up. Because we are the greatest Americans in this country. And it is time for a change, and we're about to get one. Thank God.
Talking again with the Pigman, Brian Kwaka. All right, Brian, so what do you have coming up on the TV show, buddy?
We held off our season premiere simply because of all the playoff games and the Super Bowl, of course.
That's smart.
But we're starting in Maine with moose, and then we cruise into Africa for the elusive bush pig for a couple of shows. Dude, we got some really good stuff coming up. I'm continuing to raise the bar in production and bring the heat and stack them deep and sell them cheap. That's what I do, Cam.
That is fantastic. Was this your first time hunting in Maine?
Yes, sir. Let me just give you a little story.
Yeah, please do.
The people at Kittery Trading Post, big store up in Kittery, Maine. I go up to do an appearance, and I ask every single fan that comes by, hey, you guys got a tag for Maine moose? I had no idea it was that hard to get. Some people's been applying for 25 years that are residents, and they never drew a tag. Long story short, one of the employees for Kittery Trading Post drew the tag and had me on his tag as a sub-permittee, called me and said, hey, dude, you got a moose hunt. And now that is how Americans act. That's
wow.
The way it is. Don't tell me how my people are in my industry and talk down to us until you know the facts. That dude didn't know me from Adam, and he gave me his once-in-a-lifetime coveted moose tag. Can you believe that?
That is amazing. But, you know, again, that is the perfect story that sums up this industry, because it's more than just an industry. It really is a community.
Thank you.
Well, listen.
That's exactly what it is. I meet some of my – dude, people come up to me here and offer us hunts all over the country, and that's what I'm going to start doing a lot more of, is interacting with the fans and putting them on screen and just kind of rousting about through the U.S. and just shooting whatever needs to be shot.
Well, I tell you what, man, you've always got an opportunity in a home in Central Virginia. You want to do some hog hunting? We do actually have some hogs in Central Virginia. So you let me know when you want to come down, but we will make this happen this year.
We got to do some hunting together, man. I'm tired. It's been 4 years and we hadn't done it, but it's time.
All right. We're going to put it on our bucket list for 2016. We will get it done. Brian Kwaka, the Pigman himself. You can check out Pigman on Sportsman Channel. Brian, we're almost out of time, unfortunately, but have a fantastic rest of the Great American Outdoor Show. Where are you headed next? You going back to Texas for a little bit?
Going back to Texas, dude. We're hitting it pretty heavy here on this trade show run. We've been running for a couple of months hard, and I got to have a little downtime with my son. But, Cam, I love you, Bo. And if you need anything from me, please let me know. And if you're not an NRA member, you better run. Get online and get signed up today and protect that Second Amendment right. Thank you so much.
All right, brother. We'll talk to you soon. Brian Kwaka, the Pigman, with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company from the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And, yes, as I said, I'll be going back up there. Friday night will be there, Saturday, Sunday. I was thinking about it. I don't think I'm going to be able to do it. But tonight in Harrisburg at the National Civil War Museum, there is a reception for the Guns and Lace exhibit that is going on. And I mean, you know me, I'm a history buff. I would love to be able to get up there. Kind of figured, all right, if I left here right at 5, soon as the show is over, got in the car, started driving, if I didn't hit rush hour traffic, I could probably be there by 6:45 or so, maybe 7. Danny Lyons is in our control room. Danny, what do you think the odds are of me not hitting rush hour traffic, leaving Washington, D.C., or the D.C. area at 5 o'clock?
You will hit traffic. You will.
So I probably will not be driving up to Harrisburg because I have a feeling that if I left at 5 o'clock, it would probably still be 9 o'clock by the time I got up there, which is right about the time that the exhibit, the reception ends. So if you are in the Harrisburg area, though, it sounds like it's going to be fascinating. I should tell you, though, apparently there is going to be a protest. At least one has been scheduled. Outside of the National Civil War Museum there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Yep. Why? Well, apparently, you're not allowed to talk about history anymore. And you're not allowed to display historic items anymore. Christine Vindel has the story at PennLive.com. The NRA-sponsored gun exhibit at National Civil War Museum in Harrisburg triggers protest. She says, to longtime civil rights leader Homer Floyd, William Quantrill was a terrorist, plain and simple. He led the massacre of 180 civilian men and boys in Lawrence, Kansas during the Civil War. Quantrill also kidnapped runaway slaves and returned them to bondage. So when Floyd heard that Quantrill's revolver was a centerpiece of an NRA-sponsored exhibit about guns at the National Civil War Museum, he thought it was, quote, grossly insensitive. It's history. Floyd says, it seems like we're working at cross purposes when one of our local institutions is hosting that kind of exhibit. He said, we thought we ought to speak our minds on it. I'm all in favor of people speaking their minds. I'm going to speak some of mine, actually, when we come back, start of hour two. Stick around. There's more NRA News Cam and Company sponsored by Nosler coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Vicki Callmaker. Vicki's with Vicki. You do so much. Women's Shooting Academy, 1 Million United, Safety Academy. Where do you want to start? Should we start with Women's Shooting Academy?
Absolutely. Let's start with Shooting Academy.
All right. Welcome to NRA News. What's it all about?
The Women's Shooting Academy really came to be, I thought I was just going to teach one class, right? I thought I was just going to teach women how to shoot a gun. And over the last 7 or 8 years, it's just really evolved into something that I could have never imagined. And I've trained thousands of women. And I'm just all about the art of self-preservation.
What is that? Tell me what you mean when you say the art of self-preservation.
You know, I want women to realize that they're worth protecting, their family is worth protecting, and obviously, you know, if we're going to go gun, that is the equalizer. I'd like to see every woman carrying a gun. But at the same time, I realize that a gun is not for every woman. And so it's really taking her on a journey, a personal journey, about her personal safety and getting her to realize that she can own it, she can embrace it, she can fight for it, and she can lose it.
Wow. So how do you do that at Women's Shooting Academy?
Well, our most popular class is called Introduction to Handguns. And what I do with the students is they show up, they spend about 5 or 6 hours with me in the classroom. They learn how to load and unload. They learn everything there is to know about a firearm. And part of that is teaching them the lingo so that when they end up at the gun counter, they don't sound like an idiot. And teaching them the proper way to stand, to hold the gun, really focusing on the fundamentals. Then I take them to the range, and I provide the guns, the targets, the ammunition, and they shoot 5 calibers. They shoot both revolvers and semi-automatics. And after an 8-hour day, they're ready to go to the gun counter, and they can do that alone. They can buy their first handgun by themselves. And then, you know, if they want to come back and take some additional training, absolutely. If they want to get their concealed carry permit, we can do that. They want to learn about shotguns for home defense, we can do that. I'm really excited because I'm starting to see that women want to shoot the big guns. They want to shoot the ARs. They want to shoot this fun stuff. And when they realize it's not as complicated as they thought,
right,
they're in.
There you go. Speaking with Vicki Callmaker, so let's talk about 1 Million United. What is that?
So 1 Million United actually started out to be very political. And it was my answer back to Mr. Bloomberg several years ago. Don't tell us we cannot unite. So hence 1 Million United.
Right.
But over the last year and a half, it's evolved. And what I decided to do with One Million United was to turn it into a 501c3 nonprofit. Because I believe that there's women across this entire country who need to hear what I have to say. And I want to offer that to them 100% no charge. I see myself on a large platform teaching safety seminars and really uniting women. And so One Million United will be 100% donor funded. And, you know, I got to learn how to raise money. I don't know how to raise money, but I need to raise money. And so that will allow me to just broaden my services. You know, I've got my for-profit companies. Let's do something that will benefit every woman across the country.
All right, almost out of time. How can we get more information about everything you're up to?
Go to VickiCallmaker.com, and from there you can find One Million United, the Women's Shooting Academy, and everything else I do.
Vicki Callmaker, thanks for what you're doing. You're doing so much, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Stay in touch with us. How about
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Tom Scott of FN America from the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Kelsey Harkness from the Daily Signal with the latest on Operation Choke Point. Coming up in hour three as well, we have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCor Defense, the Deal of the Day. Good Guy of the Day, plus Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report talking about the New Hampshire primary, as well as his latest column. Is this the beginning of the end of Hillary as a candidate? Heather Marchese, 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control, also coming up in hour three, talking about the House passage in West Virginia of permitless carry. But before we went to our break here, we were talking about Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and the National Civil War Museum. We had Wayne Motz, the CEO of the museum, on the program yesterday, along with Abraham Lincoln. And I thought it was a fascinating interview. And one of the questions, and I asked, we had this interview before I knew that there was going to be a protest tonight outside of the National Civil War Museum. But we talked about the importance of actually remembering our history and learning our history. When it comes to the Civil War, we're not remembering anything. We have to learn about it. And that involves learning about all of the Civil War. And when you think about the enormity and the scope of the Civil War, not just the actual fighting that took place between 1861 and 1865, but you think about everything that built up to that outbreak of hostilities, where brother turned against brother, family turned against family, where a nation went to war with itself. You've got to go back long before 1861. When you talk about the aftermath of the Civil War, it didn't stop in 1865 at the surrender by Robert E. Lee at Appomattox. You've got to talk about Reconstruction. You've got to talk about the rise of the Radical Republicans. You have to talk about the desire by all of, well, not all, but most of the geographic regions of the United States, North and South, to end Reconstruction, to try to turn the page in the late 1870s. You're talking about a period of time in American history involving decades, millions of lives, and issues that tore this country apart. And when you're in school, elementary school, middle school, high school, heck, maybe even college, you might learn the basics. You might learn the dates. Maybe you learn a name or two. But you probably don't learn much. But when you go to a place like the National Civil War Museum, you can start to get an idea. Through artifacts, we can learn about the individuals who participated in the events that led to the Civil War. The individuals that took place in the war itself, on both sides, the individuals who tried to prevent the Civil War from breaking out on both sides. And you can, and one of the things I think that we talked about this with Wayne Motz yesterday, the animosity, the enmity the hatred, the downright hatred that Americans had for one another, to actually go to war with itself. You don't do that when you just have disagreements with somebody. And there was perhaps no place more violent before the Civil War broke out than Kansas. As a matter of fact, in the 1850s, they called it Bleeding Kansas because of the sort of guerrilla warfare that took place between slave owners and abolitionists in Kansas. Now, the ostensible reason for this protest outside of the National Civil War Museum in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania tonight is a gun that was owned apparently by William Quantrill. It was a member of the Confederacy, was a guerrilla, irregular, but in Kansas and Missouri, you had a lot of guerrilla warfare outside of the standard battles that took place maybe in the northwest Arkansas, the Pea Ridge area. It was the 19th century equivalent to gang warfare. And communities, it was a story of the Civil War just honed down to a local level where you had, again, towns turning against one another, families going to war with the family of the next farm over. And this lasted, again, a lot longer than the Civil War itself because it began before the Civil War. John Brown, who was seen as an abolitionist martyr when he tried to take over the U.S. Armory at Harper's Ferry, then was hung from the gallows. He moved to Kansas in the 1850s to go to war, his own personal war against slave owners. You had slave owners who made it their business to go to war with those abolitionists who were moving in and trying to turn Kansas into a free state. It was bloody. It was awful. And yes, we should absolutely learn about these things. The good, the bad, and the ugly. We shouldn't try to take sides with our knowledge of history and the events that happened in this country. Floyd says, it seems like we're working. This is a Homer Floyd, the guy who's leading the protest. He's the head of Pennsylvania's, or was the head of Pennsylvania's Human Relations Commission. And he said, it seems that we're working at cross purposes when one of our local institutions is hosting this kind of exhibit. What would the answer be? And we're talking about a museum here. What would the answer be? To take out every artifact that once belonged to a Confederate? To only put on display firearms, uniforms, whatever that the Union Army wore or carried? Only display, this exhibit is guns and lace, so only display dresses or fashion from above the Mason-Dixon line? What purpose would that serve if we're trying to teach people history? He said that we plan to stand in front of the building during the hours of the event tonight. This is a publicly owned institution. We just think it's a bad message to be sending. I'm not sure how. Wayne Motz is quoted in the story at Penn Live. Says, you know, many items held and displayed here have a violent history. He said, that's no different than a lot of other museums. Take, for example, the Derringer, which John Wilkes Booth used to assassinate President Lincoln, held by the National Park Service and displayed at Ford's Theater. And this Colt revolver allegedly carried by William Quantrill was supposed to have fallen out of his pocket during the massacre in Lawrence, Kansas in 1863, where more than 180 civilians were murdered. This was a brutal and awful part of a brutal and awful war. But I see no reason. As a matter of fact, you know, if you think that William Quantrill was no more than a terrorist, a man who murdered and led the individuals who helped to murder 180 individuals, why on earth would you not want to talk about that? Why on earth wouldn't you say, okay, we're going to use the display of this firearm as a jumping off point to educate Americans as to who we think William Quantrill really was? Instead of saying, nah, just hide that gun somewhere. Don't talk about it. No, talk about our history. Don't hide it away. By the way, the museum has already owned the gun. The gun has already been on exhibit before without any protest whatsoever. But the mayor of Harrisburg, Eric Papenfuse, told Penn Live that because this gun is being displayed in a partnership with the NRA, it was, quote, particularly revolting. He said that the exhibit is a, quote, sellout to modern-day gun manufacturers. Huh? He said museums shouldn't let sponsors dictate the content of their exhibits any more than newspapers should let advertisers dictate the content of their journalism. Uh-huh. Now, apparently, the mayor of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, has had issues with the National Civil War Museum to begin with. And we talked with Kyle Weaver, the NRA's Executive Director of General Operations, on the program yesterday, and he kind of just laid out the some of the problems that the mayor has with the NRA. We talked about the grievance that has been filed by the Harrisburg Fraternal Order of Police against the mayor after the mayor told officers that they couldn't work security at the Great American Outdoor Show. Now you've got the mayor of Harrisburg going after a museum that was the recipient of a grant from the NRA. And again, who's the mayor really going after here? You can try to make it about the NRA. He's really going after the National Civil War Museum. He was really going after police officers in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That's who he was really hurting. He says the Quantrill artifact is not properly contextualized in the exhibit. Well, how would he know? I'm just out of curiosity. Since I doubt he's been in there to take a look, how would he know? And we get this bit of hyperbole. He says, why are we celebrating the gun of a mass murdering racist sociopath? You're not celebrating it. You're displaying it. Cities, he says, from Baltimore to New Orleans are taking down their Confederate monuments. We are putting up new ones. It's not a shrine. It's not like they're, you know, taking the National Civil War Museum and turning it into a shrine for William Quantrill. They have a display. They're displaying a firearm that has been displayed before. And here you have the mayor of Harrisburg losing his mind over this. Or maybe trying to, in a more calculated fashion, manufacture some outrage over the National Rifle Association being in town for the Great American Outdoor Show. Motz says Quantrill's gun being shown with other guns manufactured by Colt and four other manufacturers. The exhibit intended to highlight guns used during the Civil War made by manufacturers that are still in business today. Mott said many of the firearms in the exhibition are identified to Union and Confederate soldiers, as well as prominent statesmen. We are exhibiting weapons from both sides of the war as part of the presentation. Mott says the information presented with Quantrill's gun doesn't delve into details about the 1863 atrocity. He says we've identified the revolver for who owned the weapon and its significance. So this is not an exhibition interpreting guerrilla warfare during the conflict, so it's a simple label of identification. But hopefully, someone going to any museum, if the museum is doing its job correctly, hopefully anybody leaving a museum will be inclined to look for more information on their own. And again, the mayor could have used this as an opportunity to say, here's who William Quantrill was. But the idea that, again, you would say an artifact has to come out of a museum because we don't like who owned it. Or an article, can you imagine the National D-Day Museum, for instance? If people decide, well, you know, we don't want to talk about who the Allies were fighting there on D-Day, because we don't want to get into that ideology, so we don't want to display anything from the Nazis that the Allies fought there on D-Day. If the National World War II Museum took out any reference or any mention to the individuals and the nations that that we fought in World War II. We can't talk about the Axis. Only talk about the Allies. And you can't even really talk about the Axis in terms of the Bataan Death March. You can't talk about the rape of Nanking. You can't talk about this because, it's far better just to leave that part of history aside. I don't understand that attitude. I really don't. The more we know about where we came from and how we got here, again, warts and all, good, bad, and ugly, the more we recognize that we actually are no better or worse than the human beings that have come before us. There have always been awful people. There have always been people that we try to emulate. In every war, there will be those who commit war crimes, and there will be those who act with such valor that they are commended as heroes by their nation. I stayed up until about 3 o'clock this morning after I drove back from Harrisburg reading Clinton Romesha's book, Red Platoon, which is coming out in early May. I said I was on page 113, maybe it was 117 when we talked with Clint on the show yesterday. Finished it last night. Couldn't put it down. When it comes out, buy the book. I'll let you know as soon as it's available for pre-order. Because that is a story that talks about the valor and the courage, not just of Clinton Romesha, but the guys that he served with. Who put their life on the line and in some cases lost their lives. Yes, in defense of this country, but more importantly, in defense of their friends, in defense of their comrades, in defense of their fellow soldiers, their teammates, their guys. I don't think that you could put a little paragraph description on that gun used by William Quantrill that would convey the scope of that night in 1863 when a band of Confederate cavalry rolled into Lawrence, Kansas and began massacring civilians. How could a paragraph convey the enormity of that act? But the answer, again, is not to remove that firearm from a historic display. Frankly, the answer is to encourage more people to learn more about their history, as opposed to saying that some history just should be blocked off, shut away, never to be spoken of again. That doesn't work out so well. All right, when we come back, after a quick timeout here on NRA News Cam and Company, we're going to head back to the Great American Outdoors Show. Tom Scott with FN America will join us later in the hour. Kelsey Harkness of the Daily Signal going to be with us on the program. Stick around. We have much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bethany Mullen with NRA Community Outreach about the NRA Refuse to Be a Victim program. Tell us, Bethany, what's the program all about?
Well, Refuse to Be a Victim is a crime prevention and a personal safety program. It was created in 1993 by the women of the NRA. It was created specifically for people who didn't feel comfortable carrying firearms, but they still wanted to take a proactive role in their safety. It was women only from 93 to 97, but now it's open up to everybody since people realize that regardless of whether or not you do carry a firearm, there are situations that you want to be aware of so you can stay safe in your everyday life.
So this is a very successful program for NRA. Why was it important that NRA offer a program like this?
Just for people that, like I said, didn't feel comfortable carrying a firearm but still wanted to create a safety plan for themselves. It's really comprehensive. It goes over a whole bunch of different things. It's a four-hour seminar format. It goes over personal safety, travel security, home security, cybersecurity, a whole bunch more. Everyone that attends a seminar does get a comprehensive safety handbook with a lot of stuff that can't even be covered in the 4 hours. And it's just a lot of good tips that you can integrate into your everyday life to avoid becoming a victim of crime.
That's awesome. And the program, Bethany, has continued to grow and evolve now. Way you mentioned cyber, there's so much security, not only around you physically, but online and everything else you got to be aware of as well.
Yeah.
So who's a typical person who takes this program? You said it's not just women, men and women.
Correct. We really have a wide audience. We're working with a lot of police departments because it is just such a great community outreach. So they offer it to their community. A lot of people go to senior centers and talk to people that live in the senior centers. We're also working with a lot of schools and colleges because that's such a vulnerable age. You know, a lot of 18-year-olds leaving home for the first time. And college campuses, you know, obviously seem very safe, but behind the scenes, there's a lot that goes on, and so we want to make people aware of how to stay safe.
How do you get more information about NRA Refuse to Be a Victim?
Well, you can go online to refuse.nra.org or email us at refuse@nrahq.org.
I'm speaking with Chris Midget with the Firearms Guide. Chris, you've got a really exciting, neat product. Tell folks, what is the Firearms Guide?
Firearms Guide is a huge firearms, airguns, and ammunition searchable guide or a reference guide that it's online. Web address is firearmsguide.com. It's a subscription-only website, but it's not only a website. It's a huge searchable firearms and ammunition reference guide that it has its own search engine built inside of it, so all the users can actually search all these guns by the 14 different search criteria, by caliber, by country of origin, by year of production, by the type of the gun. Do I want to check rifle or a shotgun? Do I want to check semi-automatic shotgun over and under shotgun, side-by-side shotgun, or maybe lever-action shotgun?
Wow, that's impressive. So So how did this come about? It sounds like a really neat resource to have.
Yes, we've been developing this for over 8 years. We published 5 previous editions on DVDs, and this 6th newest edition will not be published on DVD. We actually just publish it online in the form of searchable database.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So who's the kind of person, Chris, that would use the Firearms Guide? Give me a typical customer.
You know what? Typical customer is any gun enthusiast. Let me say that you're looking for a new concealed carry pistol. How are you going to find? You cannot Google these things. You cannot put in a Google, please show me concealed carry pistol. You press search and you get 65,000 websites. With us, you go to Firearms Guide. First click, you click on handguns. Then you choose caliber. For example, let me say 380. Then after that, you choose barrel length, because barrel length is
right.
Also one of the search criteria. So you choose something small, like 3-inch barrel length.
Right.
You want your concealed carry pistol to be light. So you choose frame material instead of steel. Let me say, let it be polymer.
All right, before we run out of time, how do you get more information about it?
Please go to firearmsguide.com. Everything is there.
Firearmsguide.com. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much. Keep good work.
Welcome back. Thank you so much for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nosler, our on-location sponsor from the Great American Outdoor Show is AdCor Defense. Kelsey Harkness with the Daily Signal going to join us a little bit later on in the hour, talking about the latest with Operation Choke Point. Next hour, Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report, Heather Marchese from 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control, talking about permitless carry. But right now, I want to go back to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Tom Scott with FN America is on our set right now. Tom, how you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great, Cam. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's good talking with you, and I know that the booth there has been busy in the Shooting Sports Hall. You having a good Great American Outdoor Show so far?
Oh, we're having an excellent show. We've had tremendous traffic every single day, including today, so we couldn't be happier.
That is awesome. Now, a couple weeks ago at the SHOT Show, you introduced the FN Military Collector Series, right?
That's correct, Cam. We really thought long and hard about who we are and what we do, and we're here to tell the world that we're the most battle-proven manufacturer of firearms in the world. We have been producing the majority of the U.S. military small arms for quite some time now, and we're following all that up with the new Military Collector Series, which allows the public to buy very similar versions of the M249 SAW and the M4 and the M16 in semi-automatic versions.
That is awesome. Now let's just get this out of the way here, Tom, because already, you know, we hear anti-gun advocates try to say that the guns that they want to ban, these semi-automatic rifles in this country, are, quote, modern battlefield weapons of war. And they're not. I mean, there is a big difference between the semi-automatic firearms that you're offering and the military versions of these. I'm guessing if you put the semi-automatic versions of these in the hands of one of our soldiers overseas and said, here, use this, they'd look at you like you were crazy and say, well, no, where's my gun? Where's the one that I'm supposed to be using?
That's correct. The firearms that we sell to the consumer market are all semi-automatic. That means every time you pull the trigger, one bullet goes off. That's it. One round goes off for every trigger squeeze. So it's no different than a bolt-action rifle or a semi-automatic rifle that you can buy for hunting.
All right. So, you know, the aesthetics may look similar. I suppose, there are a couple of different markets here, right? I mean, you've obviously got guys who have served in the military, who have used the military versions of these firearms. They may be very comfortable with the functionality and the feel of the firearm. But then you also have those who support our military and those who want to honor our military.
That's correct. I mean, what we're offered here is a gun that anybody that carried it overseas, if they want to come home and show their family what they carried and have it show their friends when they come over, they can accomplish that. Or we offer it also for folks like you and me that like to go out with our kids and our families and our friends and enjoy the shooting sports.
Absolutely. And so tell me about the firearms that are actually in the Military Collector Series, Tom.
Okay. First and foremost is the M249S. The S is for semi, and it is a very close replica of our famous M249 SAW. It shoots either belt-fed ammo or standard AR-15 mags. So that's the first. The second, we have M4 and the M16. Some people may know we've had these contracts for quite a few years with the U.S. military, with the Army and the Marines. And you can buy an M4 or an M16 that is set up very similarly, except it does not go to full automatic, obviously, so it has a different trigger group.
And what's the reaction been, Tom, with the launch there at SHOT Show?
Oh, it's been spectacular, especially on our M249S. We've been overwhelmed with orders. We've pretty much are selling everything that we can make, so... We're trying to work through that now and figure out how to make more.
Well, that is fantastic news. And are these firearms on display there at the Shooting Sports Hall of the Great American Outdoor Show?
They sure are. You can stop by our booth. We've got several folks there that are more than willing to walk you through them and let you handle them and tell you all about them.
Oh, that's great. I mean, that's one of the nice things about a show like the Great American Outdoor Show is it's an opportunity for not just the consumer to get a chance to interact with the manufacturers, but it's also a chance for the manufacturers to get a chance to talk with the consumers. I know that's really important for you guys, too.
That's right. There are only a few times we can do this. I mean, the NRA annual convention here in Harrisburg, and also there's an event called TIFF, the Texas International Firearms Festival, that really there are three venues for us to get out and talk to the most important people to our company, and that's our customers. So we really do value that. We actually have four iPads set up on stands with surveys, and we're asking our customers as they come into our booth to tell us what they think about our products and what we can do better. So it's a great opportunity for us, just like you said there, Cam.
That is awesome. Well, listen, Tom, I really appreciate you coming on the program. I hopefully we'll get a chance to stop by the FN booth on Saturday or Sunday morning here before the Great American Outdoor Show wraps up and get a chance to say hi and take a look at the FN Military Collector Series.
Thanks a lot, Cam. Appreciate you having us.
Absolutely. We'll talk again soon. Tom Scott joins from FN America. They're at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I got to tell you, it sounds like it is another busy day there in Harrisburg at the Great American Outdoor Show. It is stunning. It really is truly stunning. There is I thought yesterday we would see a real sizable, noticeable drop in attendance because we were having some snow and, you know, the roads were kind of – actually, the roads were pretty good. But anytime the snow starts falling around here, things shut down. I kind of thought that would be the case there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That was not the case at the Great American Outdoor Show. That was not the case at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex. It was busy there yesterday afternoon. It has been busy every day that I have been there. Saturday, I mean, you drive by, the show's the doors open at 10 o'clock during the weekdays. It'll be 9 a.m. on Saturday, and I believe I'll get to the Sunday hours here before the end of the show. You drive by an hour before the show's doors open, and there's already a line to get in outside the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex on a Monday, on a Tuesday, on a Wednesday. You've got families who are taking kids out of school for the day. It's a good field trip. You got a lot of families who will show up. Maybe dad and mom gets the opportunity to take off from work a little bit early, and they'll take the kids out there. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You start seeing more families showing up. But it is it really is just a truly amazing event. It's such a big space. It would take you just walking full speed, not stopping for anything, even to say hi or to stop when something catches your eye. It would take you easily 45 minutes to walk from one end of the complex to the next. And that's if you're able to walk at full speed. But why would you want to do that? Because then you're going to miss everything. So take a day, at least, I'd say two. I was there Saturday. Now, granted, I was working a little bit, but I was there Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. I did not get a chance to see everything. I already have a list of places that I want to go to when I'm back up there on Saturday. Like I said, maybe a day, but I'd say two just to be on the safe side. And coming up Friday, you've got Phil Robertson Unmuzzled. Saturday night, you've got the NRA Country Concert, which is going to be huge, I think. And then the show wraps up again February 14th on Sunday. So you do still have time to plan your trip to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And we'll be talking with more folks from Harrisburg throughout the week here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Now, coming up in just a couple of minutes, Kelsey Harkness with the Daily Signal is going to join us talking about Operation Choke Point, the program that targeted industries, not just individual businesses that the government thought was doing something wrong, committing a crime. Operation Choke Point targeted industries that it found unpalatable. The FDIC put out guidance telling banks and financial institutions, hey, listen, if you do business with anybody in these industries, you're opening yourself up to a lot of regulation. We can come in and we can look at your books because, you know, we think there's a lot of fraud that takes place in these industries. So just so you know, if you're working with anybody in these industries, we're going to be keeping a close eye on you, bankers. As a result, a lot of financial institutions said, all right, we're going to cancel our relationships with individual businesses that might be in these industries, like the payday loan industry or the firearms industry. The government also said, anybody working with Ponzi schemers, beware, we're going to take a close look at you. So that's what they consider. They consider the firearms industry to be akin to a Ponzi scheme. The industry itself suspect under the Operation Choke Point investigation. There have been attempts in Congress to end this program, to make it clear that let's go after wrongdoers. Let's go after people who are actually breaking the law. Let's not go after people for being engaged in a lawful industry and for being engaged in a lawful business because you don't like the industry. That's not government regulation. That is using the government to target industries that those within the government don't particularly like. So again, we'll talk with Kelsey Harkness coming up in just a few minutes about the latest with Operation Choke Point. In Maryland, we've got a couple of anti-gun bills that have been introduced. One would outright ban firearms on college campuses. Right now, it's decided on a campus-by-campus basis. I believe all of the campuses have said no. We're not going to respect the Second Amendment rights of students and faculty. Criminals, you're not welcome either, but we know you won't obey that law, so. So that kind of a symbolic measure by a legislature that wants to prove its anti-gun bona fides. Another bill, similar to what we've seen introduced in places like New York State and Connecticut via executive action, another bill would ban people on the national no-fly list from buying guns. It would prevent the state police from issuing gun permits to those on the terrorist watch list that is maintained by the FBI. Now, here's the thing. This is the AP reporting. But the AP made no distinction between the no-fly list and the terrorist watch list that is maintained by the FBI. These are two different lists. The no-fly list is a subset of the much larger terror watch list. So what is it? If you're on the no-fly list, are you deprived of your ability to purchase a firearm legally? Or if you're on the broader terror watch list, are you deprived of your ability to purchase a firearm? And frankly, either way, it's problematic. Because you can get put on that list, not because you are a terrorist, but because you have a name that is similar to somebody who actually is a person of concern. You can be put on the broader terror watch list if you live near somebody who is a person of interest, if you work with someone who's a person of interest. Doesn't mean that they think that you're a terrorist. Doesn't mean that any of your other rights go away. But apparently some lawmakers in Maryland think that your Second Amendment rights absolutely should. Now, again, we've seen folks like Governor Daniel Malloy in Connecticut say that he's going to call for executive action to do this very same thing. He said that well over a month ago. And that action actually hasn't materialized in Connecticut. For the same reason that even if this bill gets passed in Maryland and it would be signed by Governor Hogan, or Governor Hogan were to veto the bill and the legislature were to override that veto and this bill would become law, there's still going to be a problem. See, this list is not available to local law enforcement. This isn't something that is accessed by the NICS system. This isn't something that the Maryland State Police have access to when they're conducting background checks. That's not the purpose for this list. So the government would have to share this list for a purpose that it was not designed for, and there are problems there. Now, I'm sure that the current administration is doing everything it can to try to alleviate those issues, to try to make a list like this available to those states who want to deprive Americans of their ability to exercise their Second Amendment rights because they have been placed on a government list. But right now, that would take some doing by the federal government. And if the president decided that, sure, he's going to open up this list that is not available to a local state law enforcement, he's just going to go ahead and say, well, now it is. You know, he might find himself on the receiving end of another lawsuit that would argue that the president has overstepped the bounds of his presidential authority, similar to the lawsuit that we've seen filed by 27 states regarding the president's sweeping EPA rules. The Supreme Court yesterday, in a 5-4 decision, putting a halt to the administration's implementation of those rules while the case is making its way through the court system. So it would not be an easy thing for the president to do. But what is easy is for anti-gun politicians to grandstand on this issue. You know, in 2013, I know we've got to take a time out, but in 2013, Martin O'Malley, who was then the governor of Maryland, signed the Maryland Firearm Safety Act into law. Since then, we have seen homicides skyrocket in Baltimore, Maryland. Now, violent crime has continued to go down throughout most of the rest of the state. You can't credit the Maryland Firearm Safety Act. Again, violent crime is already on its way down. And nobody's using the guns that were banned in the commission of these violent crimes that are being committed. The gun control laws that were put in place in 2013 in Maryland did nothing to impact the violent criminals who are committing these homicides and assaults there in Baltimore, Maryland, where you had historically high levels of homicide last year. And the legislative response by these anti-gun advocates is not, we've got to get serious with these violent criminals. We've got to crack down on the ability of these repeat offenders to get back out on the street and commit more violent crimes. No. No, their focus is on individuals who may be on the terror watch list and to say, well, if a bureaucrat puts your name down there, you can't exercise your right to keep and bear arms. What an absurd response to a horrific problem in Baltimore, Maryland. All right, when we come back, after a quick time out here on NRA News, Cam and Company, Kelsey Harkness with the Daily Signal will join us on the show. Hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy of the day coming up at the top of the hour. Stick around. We've got more NRA News, Cam and Company, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV. Jana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you so much. Thanks
okay.
for having me.
So I follow you on social media,
mm-hmm.
and I always see, you know, you're out. Geez, you're everywhere. So I'm glad you had a chance to sit down and talk to us for a minute. But you use Nosler ammunition, and Nosler is our primary underwriting sponsor for NRA News Cam and Company. So I've been dying to get to sit down with you to talk a little bit about that. So tell us, how did you form this relationship with Nosler using
yeah,
their stuff?
Absolutely. Well, Jim Kinsey, my boyfriend and executive producer of Skullbound TV, he had a relationship with Nosler, previous relationship. He introduced me. I'm from the Midwest, from Wisconsin.
I couldn't tell by the accent.
I know.
You betcha.
He introduced me to Nosler about 6 years ago, and that is literally the only ammunition I have used. And for all six seasons of Skullbound TV, we're filming right now for season six, and it's just so incredibly accurate and dependable. I did a really neat episode this year. You know, Nosler was founded on one of their moose hunts gone bad years ago, the ammunition, not on Nosler ammunition, but,
right.
you know, they founded the ammunition company because they needed something more reliable after this bad encounter with a moose hunt. And I ended up drawing an incredible moose tag, went into Alaska, do it yourself, rented the horses, packed in, ended up just being blessed with a 64-inch bull moose.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, those Nosler bullets did the trick.
And I'll tell you what, Janet, whether you're shooting, hunting like you do,
mm-hmm.
shooting competitively, it, you know, this is probably, if not outside the firearm, the most important thing to be a successful shooter.
It really is. I mean, a lot of things can go wrong, but it's so nice when you realize that, you know, especially like with a moose or an elk, they're such big animals. You need your ammunition to perform beautifully. And I got into long-range shooting about 3 years ago. I've trained with some of the best sniper champions, world champions. They all use Nosler as well. And
wow.
it just when you can take out, you know, a lot of things can grow on you. And, of course, you need to plug in all your ballistics, and you've got wind and altitude
right.
and all these things. But when you have ammo that you can count on to perform the way it's supposed to, and, you know, when it says it's, you know, their ballistics are what they say it is,
right.
it's just a beautiful thing.
It takes out one of those nagging variables, whether the weather and the, you know, that's so great. Speaking with Jana Waller with Skullbound TV about Nosler. So let's shift gear a little bit and talk a little bit about what's going on with Skullbound. How long have you been doing the show?
We are airing season 5 right now. It's amazing. Cool. I'm so blessed.
So going from when you started to now, did you ever think that this would be happening?
I really didn't. I did not. I didn't foresee the success that it would have. And we just feel so blessed that things have come together the way they have. Our hunts have gone well. I feel even more lucky to have the platform for my personal conservation causes, because conservation is a very passionate topic to me. We always include a conservation piece on every episode, but it's also given me the platform to start taking veterans out hunting. Right. And it's been seriously some of the most fulfilling moments of my life. I took another Army veteran double amputee out this year on his first elk hunt, and he got his bull on day 2, and there were tears all around. And I have to say, when I told Nosler that I was taking another Army hero out, they built him the gun. They gave him the ammo. You know, they have been such a tremendous supporter of Skullbound TV and our veterans. And it just is one more reason I'm so proud to be partnered with them.
And it's something I've been following, too. We've had you on before with Cam a number of times talking about that. I follow it on social media. It's so great that you do that. And isn't it great to have it's a great agenda to have to begin with, you ask me, but to have a vehicle like this, you know, some of us are very lucky and blessed that we get to do what we do.
Right.
And to me, you're doing such great work. So,
well, it's a way to say thank you. And, you know, here I am in a woman in the greatest country in the world. I'm able to pursue my dreams, and I'm able to, you know, have a house full of guns, if you will, because of these men and women. And it's just a way to give back to them. And it's a wonderful platform to have that we don't take lightly.
Jana Waller, how can we get more information about you? Where do we got to go?
You can go to skullboundtv.com. Super simple. We also have a lot of information on the Sportsman's Channel website, but we're on Big Game Wednesday nights. I'm happy to be a part of this industry.
Jana Waller, thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Coming up, top of hour 3. We have our heroes, plural of the day today, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. Our deal of the day, our good guy of the day. So I'd encourage you to stick around for that. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from the Daily Signal, Kelsey Harkness is with us. Kelsey, how are you?
I'm doing great, Cam. Thanks for having me.
You bet. And thank you for staying on top of Operation Choke Point and the latest with the just sort of absurd investigation here that the federal government's been conducting.
Yeah, of course. We've actually seen some recent developments. If you heard last week, a bill finally passed the House of Representatives that would end Operation Choke Point. And we've seen a lot of Republicans, as you know, fighting to end Operation Choke Point for years now. They've held House hearings. They've had congressional investigations. They've tried to use budget tactics. And thus far, nothing has been successful in ending Operation Choke Point. So it was a pretty big deal last week when this piece of legislation passed through the House, but there's still plenty of work to do because, as far as I'm aware, there's not even a vote scheduled for it in the Senate. So I think there's still going to be plenty of news on this issue to come.
Absolutely. And for folks who are unfamiliar with Operation Choke Point, you know, I know David Brooks says the Obama administration has been wonderfully scandal-free. If you ignore all of the scandals, maybe that's the case. But, you know, it is true that Operation Choke Point did not get the coverage that Operation Fast and Furious received. You know, Operation Fast and Furious put thousands of guns in the hands of the Mexican drug cartels. Operation Choke Point was, its intent was a little bit different. I mean, this was an attempt to bully banks and to stop working with folks within a number of industries, including the firearms industry.
Yes, exactly. And we've also heard a number of members compare Operation Choke Point to the tactics we saw in the IRS scandal with the government basically abusing its power to target people in industries that it doesn't like. Operation Choke Point was initially launched by the Justice Department, and I love telling this people, the name Operation Choke Point actually came from Justice Department officials. This isn't some conservative conspiracy theory that they named Operation Choke Point. It really was the Justice Department's goal to choke off fraudsters' access to bank accounts. But what a lot of congressional investigations showed is that a lot of banking regulators at the FDIC and the CFPB really abused their power. And whether intentional or not, a lot of people, a lot of small business owners in completely legal and legitimate industries lost their access to their bank accounts and to their banking services. We saw a lot of gun sellers and ammunition sellers being targeted. A year ago, I was being contacted quite regularly from people within the firearms industry about how they believe they've been affected. Quite recently, I have not heard as many stories from people within the gun industry. If they are, then I really encourage them to reach out and contact me. But Operation Choke Point, many other industries believe it's still in full effect and really hurting them.
Absolutely. And this was, you know, again, as you say, this wasn't about finding individual cases of fraud, DOJ going in, busting businesses, right? This was that that sort of intermediate step of first there was the FDIC guidance that the FDIC eventually pulled down from its website, but basically told banks, look, if you have customers that are involved in, and I forget how many industries there were, but there were quite a few, including firearms manufacturers or the firearms industry. If you have any customers, any individuals or businesses that you're working with that are involved in these industries, understand that this opens you, the bank, up to an increased risk of investigation. We might come in and audit the books. The feds can come in and they can make your life a living hell if you've got these relationships with these clients. And that's what you're talking about when you'd say you heard from these individual businesses out of nowhere. You had businesses who had worked with banks for decades in cases. All of a sudden, now the banks say we can't work with you anymore.
Exactly. And a lot of these innocent business owners didn't even get an explanation about why their bank accounts are being shut down. And, you know, if you're a gun seller, you can understand how much of an impact it has to lose your bank account services. If you lose access to credit, you can't restock your inventory. So the government was pretty smart in its tactics in going after this by basically pressuring the banks to launch their investigations for them. And they figured out that, hey, if the banks close the accounts of these industries that we don't like and we think are at high risk for fraud, that saves us a lot of time and investigations into figuring out what who the individuals are exactly who are actually committing fraud. And I think that's why we saw so much collateral damage that happened to legal and legitimate business owners.
Absolutely. I mean, it seems like such a backwards way of trying to crack down on fraud by making it harder for legitimate businesses to conduct themselves and to run their operations under the notion, well, if we just hurt everybody, then they'll be going after the bad guys. Yeah, I suppose, but you'll also be going after a lot of good folks, too.
Yeah, and I think what I thought was interesting is last week, the bill to end Operation Choke Point in the House actually had the support of some Democrats. And I think that's because Democrats can't deny when they're hearing from their members in their state that people's accounts are being shut down out of the blue for no reason. And also, I think there's a fear of this type of government power to pick and choose who has the right to do business in America. And they think if we elect a Republican president in office, what's going to happen then? What type of Operation Choke Point like tactics could they employ? Are they going to start targeting abortion industries by cutting their access off to bank accounts? There's really no end to what could happen if the government really is granted this type of power that they've shown in Operation Choke Point.
Absolutely. All right. So next step for this bill would be over on the Senate side. As you say right now, no word of any hearings scheduled for the bill.
I have not. I am doing my best to find out. So definitely stay tuned for that. I will be watching. We're hoping that this bill will get a vote, because I think it would be likely. But what I will say is very interesting. The White House, the Obama administration, actually came out before this bill went to the House for a vote and issued a veto threat. And as you know, the Obama administration has been very quiet about Operation Choke Point. It's a very secretive, under-the-radar program. So for them to issue this entire memo about why they would veto this bill, I think that signals that they're very concerned about this program being shut down. And if this bill were brought to the president's desk, I think it would force the president to speak about Operation Choke Point, which is something that up until this point we really haven't seen at all before.
No, you're exactly right. I don't think the president has mentioned those words. It's always been a surrogate, somebody within the administration. And I'm not even sure if the White House press corps asked any of the official White House spokescritters about Operation Choke Point. Do you?
I believe they would write it off as a conservative conspiracy theory. But again, I think it's interesting when you think back to the fact that it was Justice Department officials who came up with the title for their program, Operation Choke Point.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Kelsey, again, I really appreciate you staying on the coverage of Operation Choke Point. Look forward to talking again very soon.
Thank you, Cam.
You bet. Kelsey Harkness with the Daily Signal joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Now, coming up, top of the hour, I have our heroes, plural today, sponsored by AdCorp Defense, deal of the day, good guy of the day. We'll talk with Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report coming up in Hour 3 as well, talking about the New Hampshire primary, also his piece, The Beginning of the End of Hillary, question mark. Competing points of view among the self-professed thought leaders. If you look at the headlines at Real Clear Politics, for instance, at the Washington Post, Chris Saliza, Hillary Clinton has a major honesty problem. At Slate, Jamel Bowie, the road ahead looks a lot better for Clinton. Back and forth. The major honesty problem stems from the exit poll in New Hampshire, where Democratic primary voters, about 34% of them, said honesty was the most important trait in their decision on which candidate to support, more than one in three. And of those who said, honesty is my number one characteristic that I'm looking for in a politician, number one thing I'm thinking of when I walk inside that voting booth is honesty. In the Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders won 92% of their vote, compared to 6% for Hillary Clinton. That's going to sting just a little bit. Stick around. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this quick timeout.
Speaking with Kevin Neuendorf with USA Shooting. Kevin, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm doing wonderful. It's an Olympic year, so a lot of excitement building.
Man, there's a lot of excitement. So a lot of things to talk about. We want to talk about Rio, of course. We're going to get to that. But first, you have a new campaign that you guys just launched. Tell me about it.
Well, it's the Shooting is My Olympic Sport campaign. So one of the things that we're trying to do is rally a community around the aspect of Olympic shooting. So not many people know that, you know, there's 15 Olympic disciplines, shooting events. And so what we're trying to do is gather everybody around this vast community that we have and really get them to rally around our Olympic shooting sports. So, you know, not many people may follow the Olympics. They, you know, they may know of gymnastics or track and field,
right, yeah.
But we're going to bring them to shooting. You know, we can all rally around that. So that's kind of what we're doing this year.
Awesome.
Going to have a lot of fun around it. So we developed this nice new logo. And just trying to bring everybody together around our cause.
I love it. So tell us about Rio. How's it looking?
Hey, we're looking good. We've got several world champions. Of course, we've got the return of, you know, Kim Rohde, a five-time Olympic medalist.
Great Kim Rohde. What a great ambassador for the shooting sport she is.
Yeah, she's
an ambassadress. I don't know. Yeah. Whatever the right word. She's awesome.
Yeah, whatever she is, she does it really well, so including shooting. So, you know, so she's got to make her spot still. That's how competitive our events are. Oftentimes, the hardest thing to do in the United States is make our own team.
Right. It's qualify, right?
Qualify.
Yeah.
Because there's that much depth. you know, Kim competes in skeet shooting. Well, we have a world champion in Morgan Kraft, who's already earned her spot to Rio. So she beat out Kim.
Uh-oh, here we go.
So there's two spots, and Kim's in the lead right now, and we'll find out in May if she makes the team, but she's looking pretty good right now.
I'll tell you what, Kevin, backstep a little bit with me here talking about Rio then. What are, because, you know, this is where sometimes it gets competitive, confusing even for me. What are the current the shooting events that are going to be in the Olympics?
Yeah, if you think it's confusing for you, what do you think I am? So I'm trying to explain it all. We got 15 Olympic events. We got five.
Wow.
Five events in pistol, five events in shotgun, and five events in rifle.
So how does the U.S. Olympic Committee determine that? Or how's it? Because didn't one of the events that Kim was in a few years ago got changed or worked in? I know they changed the sports a lot.
Yeah, so the International Olympic Committee really kind of sets the table in terms of what Olympic events in. And they're always looking at refactoring in a whole bunch of different things, whether it be gender equity or how well they play off on television or whatever it is. So they're always adding and subtracting events. So it's determined by the International Olympic Committee, and then they work with the International Federation for Shooting.
So now listen to that, folks. 15 shooting events in the Olympics. So shooting is not only my Olympic sport, but the Olympic sport. It's a big part of the Olympics. So it's important we all get to know about it.
Yeah, there's a couple facts there that are important. USA Shooting has won 107 Olympic medals all time. We've been in every Olympics since 1896.
Wow.
A lot of people wouldn't understand the success that we've had, but we're fourth most among all medals. So if you think of the big events, track and field, swimming, gymnastics, the things that we traditionally dominate in, we're fourth best among all sports in winning
That's
medals.
Awesome.
So we've got a great history of success.
We're there to take that ride with you guys here at NRA News. We love the stuff we do with you. Before we run out of time, Kevin, how can people get more information about USA Shooting, about this new campaign?
We got to go to the website, usashooting.org. You can also find us on social media at USA Shooting. Let's rally around this idea of shooting is my Olympic sport.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Taking a look at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hello, everybody in Harrisburg. I will see you soon. Peter Roth of U.S. News and World Report join us a little bit later on in the hour. Also, Heather Marchese of 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control join us to talk about permitless carry in West Virginia. Right now, though, let's get to our Heroes of the Day, sponsored by our friends at Adcor Defense. We'll start with a story from Philly.com. Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. Stephanie Farr reporting that police are crediting a vigilant gun owner with saving the life of an Upper Darby cop on Friday after he saw the officer being attacked and surrounded by a large group of teens. Upper Darby Police Superintendent Michael Chitwood said there were 40 kids. If it weren't for the Good Samaritan stepping forward, he'd have been dead meat. There's no doubt they would have attacked him. So what was going on here? What the hell's happening in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, where you got 40 teenagers attacking a cop or getting ready to attack a cop? Well, Philly.com says around 3 p.m. every weekday, from 6 to 8 township police officers patrol the area near Upper Darby High School as nearly 4,000 kids pour out of the building on Lansdowne Avenue near School Lane. Farr writes, most kids and most days are good, according to the police superintendent. Friday was not. That afternoon alone, police responded to three fights in three locations near the school. When the dust settled, eight teenagers, aged 13 to 17, were charged with crimes, and two officers were injured so severely that it's unclear when they'll be able to return to work. Again, what happened here? The most egregious of the incidents, Philly.com says, took place on Wayne Avenue near Marshall Road, less than a mile from the high school. An officer who broke up a fight between two teenage boys that had attracted a large crowd at that location was holding one of the combatants at bay when the teen's opponent attacked the officer. Superintendent Chitwood says as he breaks up the fight, he takes one kid and then the other jumps on him. Now he's fighting two of them and he's calling for an assist officer at the same time. There's a crowd of 40 to 50 kids watching the fight and they all move in towards the officer. Superintendent Chitwood says that's when the Good Samaritan, who lives on the block, came out of his house, gun in his hand, told the teens, get away. Chitwood said he had the gun in his hand, but he didn't point it at the kids. He just told them to back off. He says, if this guy didn't come out and come to the aid of the officer, this officer would have had significant problems. 35-year-old gun owner, concealed carry holder. Superintendent Chitwood says he kept the group of teens at bay until responding officers arrived. Superintendent says not only did the officer who tried to break up the fight suffer significant injuries to his hand, but an officer who responded to the request for backup also suffered a major injury to a leg when he was kicked by one of the teens. The two juveniles in the fight charged with aggravated assault on police, riot, and harassment and related offenses, remanded to the Delaware County Juvenile Detention Facility. If they're charged as juveniles, they'll likely spend a short period of time there in juvie and then released on supervised probation, perhaps, at most. Six more individuals arrested for fighting around the same time that day at two other locations in the school. One sent to the juvenile detention facility, the other five released to a parent or guardian. They'll probably never even see an evening in juvie. Six of the eight arrested students attend Upper Darby High School. The seventh attends Beverly Hills Middle School. The eighth goes to a school in Ridley Township. Superintendent Chitwood says there are thousands of kids that walk to and from that school without a problem. But every once in a while, you get these wannabe gangsters, and if they want to be gangsters, we'll treat them like gangsters. Now, since Friday, police said after-school patrols around Upper Darby High have been doubled. Superintendent Chitwood there in Upper Darby says, our goal is to make sure these kids get home safe. Said, I can't emphasize it enough, but the majority of these kids are decent kids. Well, I'm glad that there was a decent gun owner in the area who was able to come to the aid of that police officer in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. He is our first hero of the day. Our second hero of the day comes from Warren, Michigan, WXYZ reporting. A woman was stabbed at the General Motors Technical Center in Warren. It was earlier today. Warren Mayor Jim Fouts says it's unprecedented, saying he doesn't remember anything like this ever happening. WXYZ reports a woman arrived at the visitor lobby desk at the Vehicle Engineering Center around 9 o'clock in the morning, asked to speak to the victim. Both women then went outside to have a discussion, and that's when the visitor began stabbing the other woman, according to Jim Fouts, the mayor of Warren. The mayor says that a valet driver who has a concealed carry license intervened and stopped the attack from getting worse. Again, he pulled out his firearm, and all of a sudden the crime stops. The stabbing stops. This individual, this concealed carry holder, 32-year-old Dieterul Sarder, told WXYZ that he was escorted off the property and he was fired after the incident. Fired. Not supposed to have a firearm, apparently, there on the property. General Motors sent a note to employees saying an incident occurred between a GM employee and a visitor this morning at the Vehicle Engineering Center on the Warren Technical Center campus. The situation is under control, and a full investigation is being conducted by the Warren Police Department with full cooperation from GM. The employee has been taken to a local hospital, and the suspect is in custody. The Vehicle Engineering Center lobby will be closed until further notice. They did not even mention. General Motors didn't even mention in their note to employees that attack was not stopped by members of the Warren Police Department. That, in fact, the members of the Warren Police Department were awfully glad that there was an armed citizen there to stop that attack, to hold that individual there until they showed up and could take that individual into custody. Let's not mention that part of the story. Let's not mention what that worker told WXYZ, that he was escorted off the property after saving a life and fired within minutes. Again, this happened this morning. The guy's already been canned? Well, apparently now we know the priorities there at the General Motors Vehicle Engineering Center. They are serious. about their policies that say, even if you're a concealed carry holder, do not bring that firearm with you to work. Even if the only time that we find out is when you use that firearm in defense of another's life, you will save that life, and you can feel good about it, but you will lose your job. What kind of message does that send about the safety and the security of the employees there at the GM Vehicle Engineering Center? Would you feel better or worse about the company you worked for if you were sitting there in your office or in a cubicle, you get this note, situation's under control, everything's being taken care of, but you know the story because word's gotten around. You know what your bosses didn't tell you. You know what your bosses left out. Would you feel better or worse about the corporation that you worked for? Well, we will continue to keep our eyes on the story, and it is my hope that Dieterle Sartor will not be unemployed for long. I am guessing that there are many businesses and many business owners there in the Detroit area who understand the importance of being able to protect yourself and who understand the courage and conviction and the moral center that it takes to come to the aid of another. Typically, when we see stories about a concealed carry holder being fired because they use their firearm in self-defense or in defense of another, typically these stories usually have a happy ending. Usually that individual is back to work in a very short period of time at a new location. I hope that is the case for Dieterle Sartor. All right. Our deal of the day. That was kind of a raw deal. Hero of the day, wasn't it? Deal of the day from the Houston Press. Do you remember the story, the police officer? This wasn't a story. Do you remember the police officer who was murdered in Houston, Texas? Shot and killed as he was pumping gas. Do you remember that story? Do you remember that that police officer, the sheriff's deputy? Well, the suspect in this case, a man named Shannon Miles, he was charged with the murder of Harris County Deputy Darren Goforth. He has been found mentally incompetent to stand trial. Mental health experts agreed, according to one of his court-appointed attorneys, that Miles suffered from schizophrenia and will be sent to a state hospital within the next 100 days. The attorney said, we were unable to talk to him in any coherent manner or in any manner that would be beneficial to both of us so that he fully understands what's really going on, and we fully understand everything about his case from his perspective. He was accused of shooting Deputy Goforth 15 times in the back. Charged the next day, after police located his red pickup there at his home, they found the gun the prosecutors alleged was used to kill Darren Goforth. Houston Press says before that, Miles had a history of mental illness and had been found incompetent to stand trial in 2012 for other charges. After getting in a fight at an Austin area homeless shelter over a remote control, he was charged with aggravated assault, found mentally incompetent, then sent to a state hospital. He has a lengthy criminal history, including criminal mischief, trespassing, evading detention, resisting arrest, failure to identify to a police officer. It could take 6 months to a year before a court date is scheduled in Miles' case, and that is only, again, if he is found to be competent at some point in the future. He will be reevaluated in 120 days. If he is not found competent at that point, extensions can be granted. His court-appointed attorney, Charles Brown, said it's a very long process. What we've asked people to do from the very beginning is just be patient. I don't know how it's going to end, but he will go through this system with people who care about whether or not the system treats him fairly. We often hear from anti-gun activists that the issue is not one of mental health, that focusing on mental health won't do a damn thing, that what we need to do is to pass another gun control law, or three, or six, or however many, right? Forget about enforcing the laws on the books against the violent criminals. We've got to have more laws on the books. Forget about fixing a broken criminal justice system. 97% of cases end up in plea bargains. No, no, no. The answer is to add more laws to the books. Let's put more people before a judge. And it can't be that the mental health system in this country is messed up. No, the answer always for the anti-gun activists has to be more gun control laws. Meanwhile, I'm guessing that there are a lot of people in Houston, Texas, including a lot of people who knew and cared about Darren Goforth, who are wondering, okay, if this guy was found incompetent to stand trial for violent offenses back in 2012, he went to the state hospital. Why did he get out? Was he eventually found to be competent to stand trial? And if that was the case, did he stand trial? Did anything happen to him in those charges in 2012? If he was not found to be competent to stand trial, how did he get back out on the streets? Why was he out in 2015? Why was he able to be in a position to kill Darren Goforth? Again, found incompetent to stand trial in 2012, charged with aggravated assault, sent to a state hospital. Houston Press doesn't say how long he was there. But I can't figure out how another gun control law is going to help here. I can't figure out how another gun control law is going to even really address the real situation here. But that's just me. Meanwhile, Mr. Miles, Shannon Miles, our deal of the day. Our good guy of the day. A story from Alabama. Yellowhammernews.com is the website. It's the story of a retired police officer. He's still working doing security. But he is a retired police officer officer in Birmingham, Alabama, for a couple of decades. And apparently, when you retire, you don't just hang up your character. Greg Coleman, he's now a security guard for Alabama Power. It was February the 5th. He woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning to the shouts of a neighbor who was yelling that there was a house on fire and people were still inside. Greg Coleman says, by the time I put my jeans on and I got down there, an officer was bringing out the woman who lived there asking if anybody else was in the house. All she could say was that she couldn't get the door open. She was frantic. Now, Greg Coleman, he's lived in this neighborhood. This is his community. He knew that the woman lived with a young man who was autistic. And he didn't see this young man outside the home. So Greg Coleman, who didn't have to do this, police were already on scene. He went back in that home with a police officer from Bessemer, Alabama. He said the fire was in the upstairs bedroom and smoke was pouring down the staircase, and there he was just standing there at the bottom of the stairs. The 22-year-old man has autism, doesn't speak, according to the Bessemer Fire Department. The woman in the home was his caretaker. Greg Coleman says she didn't know the two well, but he had seen them around, and he had noticed a special needs bus taking the young man to and from school every day. So they're in the home. They see the young man. Fires upstairs. Smoke coming down the stairs. Police officer shouts for the young man to come towards him. He wouldn't budge. Greg Coleman says, I just went over there. I picked him up in my arms. I carried him out. He says, I don't know if I threw him over my shoulder or what. We were just trying to get out of there. And they did. The cause of the blaze still under investigation. The Yellowhammer News says that Greg Coleman shuns the hero moniker, saying it was a team effort starting with a neighbor, Lawrence Blocker, going from house to house crying for help, and the two Bessemer, Alabama police officers who arrived early on the scene and went into the smoking home. And you know what? He's absolutely right. There was a lot of working pieces there that led to that young man not dying of smoke inhalation, but instead being rescued. Actions big and small, and they should all be acknowledged. But that doesn't mean that Greg Coleman isn't a hero. It just means that there were other heroes there that night. There were other people who stepped up, were in the right place at the right time, did the right thing. But that doesn't make his actions any less important. He said, back when he was with the Birmingham PD, he said, I always kid with the guys at the fire department that I'd rather be in a gun battle any day than a burning house. He said, but when I saw that boy standing in the burning house, I don't think I'll ever forget it. He says, I know now why everybody loves firemen. I think that everybody in that community probably loves Greg Coleman, retired police officer, now security guard with Alabama Power, who is, along with those officers from Bessemer, Alabama, along with the neighbor Lawrence Blocker, who spread the word, they are all our good guys of the day, and we certainly appreciate their actions. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Peter Roth is going to join us from U.S. News and World Report. We'll talk about the New Hampshire primary. Is this the beginning of the end of the Hillary Clinton campaign? We'll talk about that next, right here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Here in Nashville, Tennessee, we are with Stuart Sage from Jotto Gear. NRA is Jotto Gear. Stuart, you got a really cool product here. Show it to us.
All right. Well, Cameron, what we have here is our home defense cabinet. And the purpose of this cabinet is to take that firearm that you have laying around the house for home defense and lock it up so that children and burglars can't get it. You know, 2-minute national average for a burglar to get in your house and run around and find those things, guns, drugs, money, and jewelry. And the kids, obviously, you got to lock that gun up. So what we do is we take it and we hide it behind the wall in a cavity and in the mirror. Now, this is a latch system, so this latch just keeps little toddlers from playing with it. And I can come along, slide my hand up, and it'll open it up. That's not the locking mechanism. Lock's done through the fingerprint biometric system. So I take my finger and I put it in. I can put it into the light here and activate it. And you hear that lock, and now it opens it up. So I can access my firearm. After 8 seconds, it's going to lock back up. Okay. So it locks up. Lights it up. Recesses into the cavity really nice. You can also hook this up to your home alarm. It's going to treat it like a perimeter, which is very cool. Yeah. Operates on a battery, smoke detector style. So it'll start beeping at you usually at 2 o'clock in the morning, unfortunately.
Right.
So. And you just replace the batteries and off you go, you know. So it's clean, simple, install, do-it-yourselfer.
Oh, well, maybe for some people, not do it myself. So this is something that people can just order and just install themselves.
You betcha. So when it comes, you have a choice of a unfinished or a finished frame, and you can stain it you like. It's a drywall, so you just cut the drywall, install it into the wall, and you're done. There's no wiring, no electrical, self-contained. Yeah, truly do it yourself.
What is, of course, you know, we know that the gun business is booming right now. Does that also mean that your business is booming? I mean, it's got to be, I hope it's a one-to-one relationship.
Well, sure. You know, a couple years ago was it when the NRA, you know, membership grew by 1 million in that year. There's a lot of people that are very concerned about firearms and firearm safety and lock it up. And this is what this is all about. So we've seen an increase in interest, increase in activity. A lot of women are just really coming to the floor and saying, you know what, let's lock those guns up, Dad. You know, so.
Very cool. If people want to go online, find out more, buy some of this stuff, where should they go?
You bet. So go to NRAJottoGear.com.
speaking with Mike Christensen with Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike, welcome back to NRA News. You've got something neat going on for the new year, the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. What is it all about?
John, this is one of our big fundraisers for the year, beginning the first Wednesday in March. We're going to give away a gun every week for 52 weeks. At the end of those 52 weeks, everybody who didn't win a gun will go into a drawing. And then we also take all of the winners and put them in a drawing. So somebody is guaranteed to win two guns out of this drawing.
Two guns. That sounds like a good deal. So this is for Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Let's tell folks what it is that you guys do.
John, we're working to give kids who don't have a chance to get outdoors that opportunity. We're taking kids who are served by organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters and other youth mentoring organizations, an opportunity to get out, learn to hunt and fish and shoot, and enjoy the great outdoors that we all know and love.
That is so awesome. So how do folks get involved in this drawing?
They can go to outdoormentors.org and click on the Gun a Week drawing link on the front page and get signed up right there.
That is so good. Before we run out of time, once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets are available now. Start drawing first Wednesday in March. And Mike, I got about 30 seconds left. Tell folks why it's so important to get involved with an organization like yours. Why do you do what you do?
There are too many kids today who are never going to have a chance to go hunting and fishing unless those of us who love the outdoors step up and make that happen. And that's what outdoor mentoring is all about.
All right. Once again, it's the 2016 Gun a Week drawing. Tickets available now. How do folks get those tickets again, Mike?
Outdoormentors.org. Click on the link right there on the front page.
All right. So you're starting the drawing first Wednesday in March. Go there now and get information and find out more information about this great group, Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. Mike Christensen, thank you, sir, for what you do, and thank you for being on NRA News. You have a good one. Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. We're going to be talking with Heather Marchese of 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control in just a little bit with the latest on permitless carry in West Virginia. But right now, I want to welcome to the program from U.S. News and World Report, Peter Roth. Peter, how you doing, sir?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program.
I'm always happy to join you.
Well, we're always happy to have you, I got to say. And, you know, it was an interesting night last night. The winners called in New Hampshire shortly after the polls closed. Donald Trump on the Republican side, Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, holding off their challengers pretty handily. Your latest piece, is this the beginning of the end for Hillary Clinton? Do you think this is, Peter?
I'm sorry. Could you say that again, please? I sneezed.
Yes.
I missed the last part of your question.
Oh, absolutely. Do you think that this is the beginning of the end for the Clinton campaign?
It's certainly a continued downhill slide. This is not good, because you have to consider, number one, that even though she may come out of New Hampshire with more delegates than Bernie Sanders, because six of the eight so-called superdelegates are pledged to her, the other two are uncommitted, that she finished behind both Sanders on the Democratic side and Trump on the Republican side. She didn't carry women. And for the third of voters in the Democratic electorate who said that trust, honesty, integrity were the number one issues, she lost them 9-1.
Yeah. Yeah, 6%, right? 92-6 Democratic voters picked Bernie Sanders. And, you know, more than a third, according to this exit poll, more than a third of voters on the Democratic side said that that was their primary consideration. They wanted somebody who was honest and trustworthy, to worry about labels like socialism after that.
Well, now I think part of the challenge that for Mrs. Clinton is to demonstrate why Bernie Sanders is not honest and trustworthy, or honest and trustworthy either, one way or the other. And so what started off as a gadfly effort on Sanders' part has become real. And she's going to have to treat him like a real opponent, and she's going to have to pummel the snot out of him.
which is interesting, and I'm not sure, honestly, how effective this is going to be, Peter. You know, again, if a number of the Democratic voters don't think that Hillary Clinton is honest, how does she land an effective attack on Bernie Sanders' credibility?
I'm not sure that she can't. I mean, there are some things out there that I've written about that, you know, Bernie Sanders has said and has written about in his 40-year public career that are a little goofy, that she could try and highlight either on her own or through third parties. But, you know, I get the sense that people have made their minds up about Hillary Clinton. You know, this is the problem with being Hillary Clinton. It's like the problem with being Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush. Everybody knows you, and everybody's made their mind up about you. And so it's highly unlikely that once they have decided they're not going to vote for you, that they will change their minds. You remember that George Herbert Walker Bush was the first vice president since Martin Van Buren succeeded Andrew Jackson in 18-something to become where vice president became president after the president he had served without an intervening event or intervening election. And so everybody knows Hillary. She's been on the stage. She's run for president before. They've made their minds up. She was the front runner. She scared out all the other possible competition. And now people are saying, wait a minute, I'm not so crazy about this woman. So this is a very difficult proposition for her. I think she can turn it around simply through the exercise of raw political power, which is something the Clintons are very good at.
Mm-hmm.
And have proven that they are very good at. But that's not going to lead to the kind of positivist campaign that she will need to defeat the Republicans in the fall elections if she is the nominee.
You know, and it's interesting, to that end, you talk about the raw political power that it'll take. So Hillary got trounced last night in New Hampshire. I mean, there's just no way around it. And yet, Peter, I'm reading stories today talking about the superdelegates, right? So Bernie Sanders won a majority of the delegates, but there are superdelegates in the DNC that have already committed, apparently, to Hillary Clinton from New Hampshire. So she actually walks away from New Hampshire with more delegates than Bernie Sanders, even though he just crushed her in the polls.
That's an open question because superdelegates are uncommitted, unpledged. They're not locked in by primary results. So they may have been for Hillary on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
They may be for Joe Biden today. Now, they don't necessarily have to say anything until they get to the convention in Philadelphia and cast their votes. But their status as delegates to the convention is not dependent upon the results of the primary election. And so when you're doing the count, you are presuming that the six of the eight superdelegates who previously had pledged their support to Hillary Clinton are going to remain with Hillary Clinton. They're not bound on the first ballot like the delegates elected in the primary or caucus are. And this was done deliberately to prevent the crazies from seizing control of the party and the nomination process like they tried to take in 68 and like they took in 72. The Democrats did this to themselves.
They did. But, you know, what's interesting is, so let's say we get into the Democratic convention and that the party, you know, is facing that insurgency of the Sanders campaign, but through the sheer force of will, through the Hillary delegates and through the pressure from the DNC, despite the groundswell of support for Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton ends up the nominee. Peter, I got to think. I mean, the Daily Beast had a story today, quoting a number of Bernie Sanders voters in New Hampshire, who said under no circumstances would they vote for Hillary Clinton. If it gets to that point for the Democrats, where you know, they're using the rather underhanded tactics, parliamentary tactics, to declare Hillary Clinton the nominee. That's not going to end well for the party. I mean, there's going to be a near revolt on their hands.
What I'm looking for right now is the Nevada caucus, and I want to see if there are any votes for Joe Biden in the Nevada caucus, because I know that the vice president has taken himself out of the race. But he may no longer have a choice. And again, Hillary's ahead in big states like Michigan and Pennsylvania by considerable numbers. We presume she carries California. But, you know, if Sanders even runs close in South Carolina, let alone wins, that changes the whole conversation. And so to see closed activities like the Nevada caucus to slowly start to see people writing in Joe Biden, people grafting Joe Biden, you know, the folks who were behind that effort haven't, from what I've been told by my sources, haven't packed up all of their boxes, vacated the offices, and gone home. They're sort of in a holding pattern. They're waiting to see what happens.
Yeah, and so, Peter, do you think after Nevada, I mean, you know, I've been looking at the SEC primary March the 1st. You got more than a dozen states as sort of that date where we might see things shake out. But you think that even it could come even earlier than that if Bernie Sanders is able to win Nevada, does better than expected in South Carolina. That, I mean, at that point, has the narrative been set for Hillary? There's no real recovery at that point?
It's pretty close, yeah.
Interesting.
I think it's pretty, you know, unless she, you know, if she sweeps on March 1, then the narrative changes. If they split the states on March 1 and come out with roughly equal numbers of delegates, regardless of what the numbers are in terms of votes cast, the narrative changes.
And to that end, you know, you mentioned Biden's name. Biden has said apparently he's keeping all his options open after giving a speech declaring that he wasn't going to run. At some point you've got to decide you're going to jump in. Bloomberg says he'll decide by early March. Whether or not he is going to try to mount a run for presidency. He wants to see how things are shaking out. And maybe we'll know. Maybe we won't. Maybe it's still a muddled mess come early March as well. And you know, if that's the case, what do you think might happen with, you know, individuals like Michael Bloomberg or Joe Biden? Might this very strange election year get even weirder?
This very strange election year might get even weirder, absolutely. I don't think at the end of the day that Michael Bloomberg runs. I think that the pattern of third-party candidates in elections in the United States is not only that they're not effective in carrying the day for themselves, but they also make life tougher for the person who is most ideologically close to the principles that they hold. And so what Michael Bloomberg does is split the liberal vote. He doesn't touch the conservative vote. So whether the nominee is Sanders or Clinton, he makes it harder for the Democrats to win the White House, not easier, because he's not going to win the White House. If it's Joe Biden, I think that's a little bit different. I think that a late entry by Joe Biden, or a late nomination of Joe Biden, would be spun by the media as a discussion of the fall campaign of why whomever the Republican nominee is unsuited to be president, is the kind of thing where he could sort of sit and lay back and preside and hope that the Republicans were too fractured to bring the campaign directly to him. So if with the help of the media, the whole thing could be made a referendum on the qualifications of the Republican nominee, whomever that might be, Biden possibly could prevail close to narrowly in a scenario like that. But Michael Bloomberg getting in the race, I think, just helps the Republicans. And that's not what Michael Bloomberg wants to do.
No, I'm pretty sure you're right about that. Peter, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. Sure, it is always a pleasure talking with you, and I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Always good to talk to you, Cam. Thank you,
sir. Peter Roth with the U.S. News and World Report joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. After we come back from a quick break, Heather Marchese from 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control will join us. We'll talk about permitless carry in the state of West Virginia, some good news on the legislative side. We'll, again, get to that story coming up right after this quick break here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Speaking with Sean Diem with GDS Global Dynamics Security. Sean, welcome to NRA News. You are doing some very interesting and novel stuff with dog training that's got some incredible far-reaching applications with terrorism, counterterrorism, military, law enforcement. Tell us, what's it all about? What are you guys doing?
Well, we have developed a new and revolutionary behavioral science method or model and a training method that is the next generation of canine detection, of dogs finding stuff with their nose. And the implications of this are tremendous for counterterrorism, for finding bad guys, finding bomb factories, finding terrorists in a crowd. And the sensitivity of these dogs is exponentially greater than conventionally trained dogs that we're used to seeing now. For example, our dogs can consistently find 3 rounds of AK-47 ammunition on the second story of a building from 4 or 5 buildings away, off the leash, go to the building, go up the stairs, and put their nose exactly where those 3 rounds of AK-47 ammunition are. What does that mean? That means that we can find the Karachi brothers in Paris. We can find, before they strike, we can find the Sarnarak brothers in Boston before the Boston bombing. We can find the Paris attackers before they attack, because this becomes an offensive, proactive asset, and it changes everything.
So, Sean, explain, how did you get where you are now with this new approach?
I started about 25 years ago and realized that the behavioral science model, the way people thought of and saw dogs and animals, and the way they believed that their brains worked, I knew that had to be wrong because it didn't work in getting them to do things, to train them. So I started in about 1990 to create a new behavioral science model and training method. And I worked extensively with biting dogs, extremely dangerous animals that if you get it wrong, people get hurt. And in that intense environment, I was able to have tremendous control over the dogs, tremendous performance, and then I moved into working with wolves extensively. And those wolves taught me a great deal about behavior, because I could see the raw, unchanged, evolved behavior of wolves. I actually lived in a house that had several wolves in the house. I don't recommend it, but it was a great experience. That enabled me to build the foundation. And then from that foundation, I was able to construct a training method and approach that works for any working application. Then in 2011, I went to bomb dog school, and within a few days, I realized that the method they were using was minimally effective. And I've been told by many conventional trainers that they believe their dogs, when odor is available, will find it about 20% of the time. And that means 80% of the time they may be walking past it. So, and I also saw on the wall of the training room there a picture of a military bomb dog handler, and I asked about him, and he had his legs blown off with the dog right next to him. Mm. Well, that told me that this cannot be working well if the dog is not reacting in a strong way. Well, we put about 4 years into completely reinventing the method and starting from scratch, figuring out what stimulates dogs. How do we get them to indicate faster, more accurately? Our dogs will consistently indicate down to the size of a quarter where the source material is. That means explosive ordnance disposal people can find exactly where that bomb is without having to dismantle an entire wall in order to find something that's 6 inches in diameter. Our dogs narrow it down to the size of a quarter. I knew that they needed the speed. They needed the reliability. Our dogs never give a false response. They indicate almost 100% of the time. It is possible that odor is not available, and they wouldn't find it because it's not emitting enough molecules for them to find. They're more versatile, and that's how we got there, was by rebuilding the method and looking at it in a primal, evolved way.
How can folks get more information about this new approach?
They should go to globaldynamicsecurity.com. globaldynamicsecurity.com. shoot us an email. We are now looking for teaming partners, security companies, government agencies that are looking to implement a super effective counterterrorism and security asset. We're ready to work with them at globaldynamicsecurity.com.
Sean, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so much for joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming up on tomorrow's program from the Great American Outdoor Show, our friend Jen Jakes. I'm going to have to ask her, is it Jen Jakes or is it Jen Jaques? Because we were talking with Matt Jaques of AmericanSnipers.org earlier in the week. Name spelled the exact same way. Maybe I've been mispronouncing it the entire time, but we'll talk with Jen from the Great American Outdoor Show. Our friend Kurt Schlichter will join us, and Jim Garrity from National Review will be with us in studio. I believe that we will be talking with Heather Marchese, 1 Million Moms Against Gun Control, here momentarily, but if we can't reach her, then we're going to head back up to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We've got another segment that we'll share with you. I do want to let you know about the bill, however, in the state of West Virginia, permitless carry, which has passed out of the state house. Now, this is not the first time that permitless carry has passed out of the state house in West Virginia. In fact, it happened last year as well, and the bill got all the way to Governor Earl Ray Tomlin's desk with a veto-proof majority before the governor vetoed it. Now, the reason why that bill wasn't overridden by the governor is because the governor vetoed the bill after the session had concluded. And there was no special session reconvened that would have allowed the lawmakers to try to override that vote. So this year, lawmakers are moving this bill up in the legislative stack, so to speak. And House Bill 4145 passed out of the House on Monday, 68-31. Again, a veto-proof majority. What is interesting about this, Heather Marchese pointed out, there are 100 members in the House of Delegates there in West Virginia. 18 of those members are women. Yesterday, of the 18, there were 3 opposition votes to permitless carry. 15 of the 18 legislators did not vote against this bill. How about that? You know, we talked with Heather about permitless carry not long ago, and she talked again about the financial impact that this will have on West Virginians. Now, the concealed carry license isn't going away, even if permitless carry becomes the law of the land. You know, I mentioned we've been talking about reciprocity issues with Virginia. We've seen where other states have adopted permitless carry, Wyoming, Arizona, Alaska. They've kept their concealed carry license processing in place for those who travel outside of the borders of the state, want to be able to carry in other states. And as a matter of fact, in Arizona, the number of concealed carry licenses has actually continued to go up even after constitutional carry or permitless carry has gone into effect. So the bill, again, 4145, passing out of the state Senate, passing out of the state house, excuse me, now heading over to the state Senate side. And we'll continue following along there in West Virginia. But if you are a West Virginia gun owner, make sure that your lawmakers have heard from you. Do we have nope. Okay. All right. Well, we are having some trouble reaching Heather Marchese, so we'll try to connect with Heather here very soon. But I do want to head back up to the Great American Outdoor Show. Earlier today, I had the opportunity to sit down and spend a couple of minutes with Nate Hosey from Headhunters TV on Outdoor Channel. And Nate's actually got a new project as well that sounds pretty interesting. Take a look and a listen. Nate Hosey of Headhunters TV at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Nate, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here again.
Yeah, absolutely. Wish I could be there in person, but I'm glad we could still connect here. So tell me about this. You've got a new album that you've been working on, right?
Yeah, man, I'm really starting to get pretty excited. I'm playing here Friday night at an event called Unmuzzled. Phil Robertson speaking, and we're opening the night up and performing here. And really, it's been a new journey this year out in Nashville trying to get the album finished up, and we're hoping to release, hopefully, it's looking like it's probably going to be June, so I'm pretty excited about it. It's a blessing, and I hope that the hunting community will love it.
That's awesome. I mean, is this something that has always been a part of your life? You've always had that creative side?
Man, music, it's really a funny story, which the album releases and stuff, I think the public will get the whole story of how it all started. But in all honesty, it happened by mistake. And in some of the hardest times of my life, you know, the whole music scenario took place. So it's really a crazy blessing that it's gone to where it has. And the fact that I'm putting out an album is something that I'm very thankful for and look forward to everybody hearing the story.
That is awesome. Well, listen, tell us what's going on with Headhunters TV as well.
Man, you know, Headhunters TV, we're really excited. We're wrapping up filming the fall of season 6, and we're getting ready to film the spring stuff. You know, turkey season, that's my favorite season of any. In my opinion, the best season of them all. I love it. And it's really, you know, it's along the same lines. We're going to have a high-energy, kind of fast-paced hunting show going all over the country and really promoting the sport and enjoying the sport, because we are so thankful to be hunters. We're not out there trying to be the best hunters in the world. We're just out there to let everybody know we truly love it.
Well, you're up there in Harrisburg, and that's, you know, you started hunting in Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, born and raised in a small town northeast of here, Montale, Pennsylvania, and still live there right now with my wife, Tiffany.
So tell me, what was it like growing up in a state where, you know, first day of deer season, the school is basically closed because no one's coming to class? What was that like growing up?
As a hunter, I could say that I'm so proud to be from Pennsylvania, you know, a state that has such a strong hunting heritage. It's something that, as you know, when I was 5 years old and my grandpa and my dad started taking me out hunting, it's something that has really been, you know, burned into my heart. I'm very, very thankful to be from Pennsylvania and a state that has such a strong heritage. And I mean, when you close school for deer season, that's a state that I'm proud to be from.
Right. So did you grow up going to the, what was then the Eastern Sports and Outdoor Show?
Yeah, I've been coming here for as long as I can remember. And over the last few years, I am a huge, huge supporter of the NRA. I'm so thankful to them for all that they do for us as hunters and sportsmen. You know, a lot of people don't even realize all that the NRA does for us. So when they took over this show, to be involved with so many of their events, you know, the Brantley Gilbert Show a few years back, Phil Robertson this coming Friday, and to be able to come here to Pennsylvania and speak to people about turkey hunting in a state that I grew up in and that I, you know, I'm so proud to be from. This show it means the world to me. It's awesome here. I love it.
It really, you know, I've been able to go for the last 3 years, and it is so much fun. And every year, it just gets better. There are more vendors, there are more exhibitors, you know, yeah. There are more people in the aisles. And, you know, for 9 days, you've just got that community of sportsmen that are, you know, they've got a variety of different interests, but they're all there under one roof. And it's just, it's unlike any other show, I think, out there.
It really is, man. And like you said, I mean, it's 9 days. It's a haul. It's a marathon. You feel like Rocky when it's over with, especially if you've worked it all 9 days. I mean, you've done something. But when you can spend 9 days with people who love to hunt and fish and get outdoors as much as you do, I mean, it's a blessed 9 days.
Well, listen, we've only got a couple minutes, Nate, but I want to ask you, you know, you mentioned something about how much you appreciate the NRA, and I'm really glad to hear that. You know, your experience growing up in Pennsylvania, living in Pennsylvania, but then working a lot in Nashville on the album, going around the country with Headhunters TV, is that what you find as you travel around? There's also that support for the Second Amendment, support for the NRA?
Yeah, you know, I think that with the music journey and the hunting journey, people have gotten behind me and they have supported everything I've done. And for that, I'm so thankful. But in the bigger picture, they are supporting so much more, because I truly believe in the NRA. I stand behind it. And I'm proud to be a life member, because, you know, I think that in today's world, it's tough. We are constantly judged. We have a lot of people via social media, et cetera, that want to reach out to you and tell you how terrible you are, you know, how they can't stand you. But in reality, as hunters, sportsmen, you know, shooting enthusiasts, the NRA and folks like us, I believe that we have the utmost respect and more respect for animals and the sport of hunting and for people and for one another than any of those folks have. So when I get to go all over the country and talk about things, it's very important to me that people know that I am all about the NRA. I believe in it. And I'm proud to be a lifetime member of it. So, and the NRA, like I said, does the same for us because they truly are always in the corner of sportsmen, hunters, and shooting enthusiasts, for sure.
Listen, Nate, it is a real pleasure talking with you. When the album comes out, let me know because we got to have you back on the show, okay?
Yeah, man, and you know, first show after the album, I'd like for you to be there just in case I stage dive. I need you to catch me.
No problem, buddy. We'll talk to you soon. Nate Hosey, Headhunters TV. Watch for his new album coming out at the Great American Outdoor Show. Again, if you're going to Harrisburg, he's going to be taking part in the Phil Robertson Unmuzzled Spectacular, which is going to be on Friday of this week. I think I might be getting up there just in time, maybe for the encore on Friday night. But I'll be going back Saturday and Sunday as well.
Sounds great. I wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thanks, Nate. Nate Hosey joining us from the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And don't forget, the Harrisburg show, Great American Outdoor Show, runs through Sunday, February 14th. And if you do have an opportunity, really, it's a really easy drive, actually, from the D.C. area, from the Philly area. I mean, I was talking with folks who drove in from Long Island, upstate New York, Massachusetts, western PA, all over the state of PA, Virginia, Maryland, Ohio. It is an easy drive, and it is well worth your time. If you have the opportunity to make it to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, between now and February 14th, please do so, because I promise you, you're going to have a fantastic time there. You know, we have heard, you know, we've been talking about what's going on with the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that ruled, yes, these firearms that were banned under the Maryland Firearm Safety Act, these are firearms that are actually protected under the Second Amendment. And no, the trial court in this case was wrong when it tried to use intermediate scrutiny to determine whether or not these laws were valid or appropriate or whether they should be struck down. They sent this case again back down to the trial court. The attorney general there in Maryland, Brian Frosch, who was one of the lawmakers who voted in favor of the Firearm Safety Act, has indicated that that decision will be appealed. The question, though, is where it will be appealed. As of right now, we still don't know. He has said that he will seek either an en banc review or a U.S. Supreme Court review of this case. But we don't yet know where that's going to be. At Forbes, there's a new column out on the Fourth Circuit Gets the Second Amendment Right that we'll talk about on tomorrow's program. Had a lot of folks actually come up in Harrisburg and ask me about that bill, because there are a lot of Maryland gun owners who make the drive up to Harrisburg, PA. And what I said was, it's not the last word in the lawsuit, but it is a good step for those gun owners there in Maryland. All right, that is going to do it. Not just for gun owners, by the way, for Marylanders who want to exercise their Second Amendment rights in a meaningful way. It's good news for them, too, even if they're not currently gun owners. That is going to do it for this edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow, live 2 p.m. Eastern, midnight Eastern, on Sirius X and Patriot 125. We'll see you soon. Have a great day.